This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tea and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Hey, gang, just a quick reminder. This Saturday night, June 22nd, I will be at the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the Chef's Garden in Milan, Ohio, for a totally 80s dinner, a celebration of my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. Guest chefs David Waltuck of the late, great Chanterelle Restaurant and Claudia Fleming, formerly of Gramercy Tavern and other landmark restaurants in New York City, we'll be cooking with the Culinary Vegetable Institute chef Jamie Simpson. There will be a Q&A and panel discussion. There will be a cocktail reception. There will be a five-course dinner. There will be a book signing. I hope to see you there. For tickets and information, click through via the link on this Instagram feed for this show, at Chef Podcast.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
You have to create some newness every day. Mm-hmm. So every day when I walk in, something has to be new. It doesn't have to be limited to just the food. One piece or part of the experience has to be new. I have to see newness and progress.
And is this something you dictate, or is this something you look to your team to take the initiative to provide?
I push them toward it.
That is Chef Patrick O'Connell, chef proprietor of the landmark, the Inn at Little Washington.
I've always had a job. I had a job. My first job was a paper route, probably when I was like 12, you know, delivering the Boston Globe in the snow. Yeah, not so smart.
Right.
But I took a couple of odd jobs. I mean, I worked in the mailroom at Fidelity Investments for a little while. I was a chimney sweep.
Wow.
My dad had moved to Turkey. I went to Ankara and visited him for a couple of months. And I just started realizing how much I enjoyed food and how much and you know what did it? There was a catalyst. Like, there was this aha moment of making just a really good cup of coffee. And realizing, like, the minutia of that process.
And that is Chef Lincoln Carson of the just-open Bon Temp restaurant in Los Angeles, California. Our guest on a doubleheader episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I'm here with a first-time co-host, legendary, we got to say legendary, and mischievous pastry chef, Sherry Yard. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
You're my new buddy.
That's the best introduction ever.
We just met at the LA Chef Conference a month ago.
That's right.
You told me that you were pondering, I don't want to give it away, you were pondering doing something media-ish, and I said, oh, well, you should come to this three-day food media lab I'm going to be teaching at next month, which is right now, in San Francisco, at the San Francisco Cooking School.
And here we are.
And you signed up. You were sitting here with a lot of people in their 20s and 30s who were career changers and fledgling little media, just hatched media chickens. and you're sitting
this
there
old,
like
this old chicken sitting there.
It's like a high concept comedy. This is like Back to School. This is like the Rodney Dangerfield movie, Back to School.
It was fun. It's been so much fun. Yeah. So much fun. Yeah. I mean, every time you get an opportunity to meet new people,
yes,
to see what everyone's up to, everything is changing.
Yeah.
Minute to minute, second
yes.
to second.
Yes.
We have to be on top of this.
It's amazing. So you, for people who don't know, which everyone listening to this probably does, you were for what, you were 20 years with the Wolfgang Puck organization?
Just shy of 20 years.
Including Spago.
I called it dog years. It was only going to be 2 dog years. 1 year. I said, told him 2 years.
Yeah.
And it turned into 3 dog years.
Meaning 21. Right, yeah. Okay. So Spago was among the places where you worked.
Indeed.
And then you went on. One day you and I will do a full-on interview for an hour.
Sure.
But you were, what was your title with, you were the
COO
of IPIC,
the Chief Operating Officer.
Yeah, which is one of these theater change. It's the high end.
We are the premier.
Yeah, it's the high end version of
luxury group.
There you go.
We have
these are theaters where you can have food and beverage
across the country.
Yes.
Dine in the dark menu. Press
yes.
the button. And
yes, but this is the high end version.
The high end.
Of it.
They say
yes.
that I'm credited with changing the way people dine in the dark.
Awesome.
It was a lot of fun. And who better than a pastry chef?
Nobody.
Because we know how to make things that go into buns.
What does that mean?
Well, because not many chefs know how to make a bun.
Okay.
But a pastry chef does.
Okay.
But I know how to make hamburger.
Yeah, but you,
so no biggie.
You can get other things at that theater.
Oh, we get all
There's
sorts
a whole
of
menu.
Thing. Oh, it's
yeah.
Tuna and crispy rice.
All that
and,
stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. Anyway, we are here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You're a Los Angelina.
Mm-hmm.
But originally,
we had
dinner last night at Noosh.
We did.
We got spoiled
Nooshed
rotten.
At Noosh.
Spoiled rotten. I got your whole life story. It was amazing. You were originally a New Yorker from the
Brooklyn
outer boroughs of Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
You've had quite the career, and I was desperate for someone. I taught a podcast class today, and I was talking how I can't do these intros by myself. Well, I do sometimes, but it's like a last resort. So instead of doing it in my hotel room this morning, I was like, I'm going to get someone at the school
me.
Today, and then you volunteered to help me.
Absolutely.
Everyone else is off getting a coffee or a drink. The day's over
cocktail.
Here. Yeah, cocktail.
That's up next.
That's where you're headed. So, Sherry, just help. I wanted you to help me make these introductions.
All right,
and
I'm here for you.
You're being a sport. I was going to say a princess because usually
take it. I'm taking it.
People say you're a prince, but
princess
has a negative. Yeah, but that has a negative.
Princessa, I'll take it. Empress.
Well, princess is positive, but princess has a negative connotation.
It depends on how you look at life.
Jewish American princess.
I think empress.
Yeah,
but, I think empress.
Princess is good though.
Yeah, princess.
Okay, my first guest, and I'm glad you agreed to do this because you heard me talking yesterday. I went to the Inn at Little Washington last week. I have to be up front. It was I didn't touch my wallet the whole trip. My trip in was covered. The lodging, which seems like too downscale a word for what I had, a deluxe suite. It was, they call it the Charlie Trotter room. I don't think they use the word suite there, but it was a suite. I had a full on tasting menu dinner. The Inn at Little Washington is of course Patrick O'Connell's landmark American. You know, he in this interview says several times, I wish people would stop just talking about this like a restaurant. And I didn't really get that till I got there. But I get it because there is an actual inn that exists like above where the restaurant is. There are several houses that over the years he's accumulated and subdivided, I guess is the word, into these fabulously well-apportioned suites. I mean, giant tubs in the middle of the bathroom.
It's Relais Chateau.
It's Relais Chateau. It is a Relais Chateau property. There's a 3 Michelin star yeah. restaurant there. There's the farm. There are gardens. It's I don't mean this in a disrespectful way. It's basically in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
It is an American equivalent of these restaurants that Patrick and other chefs of his generation, Charlie Palmer comes to mind. David Burke comes to mind. People, Alfred Portale comes to mind. These places that in the true sense of the Michelin phraseology, 3 stars technically means, Michelin is a tire company, means worth a special journey. And very often those French chefs had these restaurants in the middle of nowhere that basically was the only reason you would ever go to these little towns, right? And Patrick has, and I did not realize this till I went there, basically created a very American, in many ways it's very Disney-ish, this place, in the best ways, but it is a proudly American version of that experience.
And now it's time for me to confess. That? I've never been.
Okay. Well, this is the thing that kills me. I had never been.
It's on the bucket list. And as, bucket list
and
of
as
life.
You know, a number of you're younger than Patrick, but you've been around enough to remember when he was coming up. Sure. The place has always been there. Everyone's always known it's there. And so many chefs of your caliber who are, you know, who know...
We know him. We love him. We've done events with him.
But they've never made the trek.
We admire. We adore.
Right. They've never gone.
Never gone.
And in the month leading up to me making this visit, when I was in L.A. at the chef conference, I asked... I don't want to name anybody. So many people have never gone. It's kind of... I feel like... And I include me as a journalist on the journalist side of this equation. I came away feeling like this is the most criminally under... valued, respected, I think it's respected, understood, truly appreciated. I think you can't get it until you've been there. It is a knockout, an absolute knockout. It's 41 years old. It's beautifully maintained. We talk in the interview. He has five people. There's five maintenance people there. It's like the White House. There's people constantly refurbishing and keeping it up to date. And it was an amazing experience. So as I said at the beginning, I do need to be up front. My promotional partner for this show, Pellegrino, brought some media people there. And I was among the group that went. That said, there was no obligation. I was not asked to do a podcast. I'd always wanted to have Patrick on the show. I was not asked to write the profile of him that I'm going to be writing. Those are my own gigs. I pitched a story somewhere. They had nothing to do with that. But I do need to be upfront about the fact that I was a guest.
Well, it sounds like it was a priceless experience.
Aren't you clever? Yes, it was amazing. I would have happily busted.
You have to share that with everyone. Everyone has to go.
I would have happily busted. I would have happily been presented with a bill at the end of the whole thing. It was just the greatest time. Okay, I don't like talking about commerce. But I do think it's important to be direct about what's covered and what's not. So Patrick and I got there. I'm jumping this interview to the head of the class. I have about 10 or 12 interviews on backlog. I just want to share it with people. So I got in there a week ago today. This show drops on Wednesday. I got in the afternoon a little bit ahead of the other media people who were coming. I was set up with Patrick in a little, it's almost like a sunroom. It's part of the dining rooms there. Overlooking this little koi pond and this little terrazza outside where people were sitting and having an afternoon drink or a coffee. And we sat at a corner table. It's his preferred perch, I later found out. And we did an interview. But before I jump to it, Sherry, from a distance, from over the years, like, how have you perceived this guy?
Perfectionist, fun. Exciting, happy.
Yeah.
True hospitality.
Yeah.
True, genuine. The word celebratory. He's just that guy that you want to invite him to every party. You want to be invited to any party where he's going to be.
Yeah, I think, it's amazing.
A legend, an absolute legend. And I'll tell you a quick story for me. Yeah. I sat at a table with him more than 15 years ago with the writer Alan Richman.
Sure.
And we were talking about favorite dishes, and Alan said it was the omelet at the Inn at Little Washington. It's the best omelet in the world. And from that moment, it was on my bucket list.
I did not have an omelet. I was in recovery mode on day two in the morning. I actually had a bagel with salmon and capers and everything. Hold the bagel. That's what I had. Oh, wow. I didn't have any bread and a lot of coffee. With all that, I'm going to just kick it over to my interview with Patrick O'Connell. I would encourage everyone listening to this show, if you have the time, if you have the means, go to this place. It is an incredible experience. Give yourself over to it. We talk in this interview about themes of seduction, of being utterly transported, of being taken to another world. That is his desired effect on you. And boy, does he pull it off in a way that I just did not. Like I said, I'm blown away.
Huh?
I pitched an article about him, and it's not like I had it in my plans to be writing a profile right now, but I feel the need to proselytize. Okay, with all that, here you go. This is my interview with Chef Patrick O'Connell of the Inn at Little Washington. I hope you enjoy it. This is my first visit here. I've known about it. I've seen pictures of it. I've seen in the last, year and a half, twice, I think I've seen the video presentation. I saw the thing you showed at the Welcome Conference. last year, and then I saw your wonderful, well, both places, wonderful speech at the Beard Awards. It still exceeds every in three dimension. It's a very different experience than even a 30-minute film about it.
That's very reassuring to hear.
Do you ever get used to it?
I'm trained only to see the flaws.
Right.
So I'm like a film editor, constantly gravitating toward the flaws.
What needs cutting.
Exactly. Yeah. And what should I not be seeing? And
right.
So the staff is quite used to that.
Yeah.
It's a very visual set
here.
It's a very visual experience.
Yes.
But there are many layers to
it.
So I always feel that its uniqueness is that if we don't reach you on one level, we'll reach you on another.
Uh-huh.
And I always find it odd that we're sort of linked into being a restaurant and competing with restaurants. And it is really so much more than that.
Oh, yeah.
So it is so far beyond what's on the plate. It is an immersive kind of feeling that has to be continuous from the moment you arrive.
Mm-hmm.
And the food, the experience, and the visuals have to be all one.
Mm-hmm.
And I often think if I were just running a restaurant, it would be like retirement. It would be so easy.
Right. And it'd be like you were running with sandbags and you took off the sandbags.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
If you only had to think about the food on the plate and nothing else.
Yeah.
But that never was enough to do it for me, even in a great European restaurant in the early days. I wanted the whole thing. You know, I wanted to be in the middle of a magnificent film that I could never forget a detail of.
Now, it's interesting to hear you say film. And I'm going to ask you this, and then I want to recede back to what I had in my head to ask you after I got here, because something struck me very powerfully on the way in and when I got here. But you have a theater background. Correct?
I do.
Background, but you've made some film. You've made at least two film references. We're here less than 3 minutes on with the recording going. You've made two film references. That's interesting. Are you a film buff?
I lived during college next door to the Circle Theater on Pennsylvania Avenue, which had a double feature that changed every 2 days.
Okay.
And they also ran midnight movies.
Oh, great. What were some?
They were all Truffaut art films, mostly French, always subtitled.
Okay. This is what we call like a repertory theater.
Yes.
Back in the day.
Yes. And I just really delved deeply into the appreciation of film as an art.
Yeah.
And then I began to see the potential for living life as a film.
Mm.
And I had sort of escaped to many places as a child, books and whatever. But a novel isn't complete enough.
Yeah.
But if you can add food to a film, you own them.
Well, you hit two other senses at least, right? Smell, taste.
Right. Yeah.
Well, actually also touch.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a film, you have sight and sound.
Sensuality.
Yeah, right.
But Warren Beatty was here and came for one night and didn't want to leave, and so he stayed three.
Back in the day or recently?
A while back.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, he said, "I can't believe you do this." And I said, "Do what?" And he said, "All we have to do is make the film." But you have to feed them, too.
Very, very perceptive of Mr. Beatty. No, was he this big foodie? You know, it's funny. You talk to someone like Barry Wine, who had the Quilted Giraffe.
Yeah.
Beatty was a regular there.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But also somebody like Silvano of Da Silvano, this little Italian restaurant that was in the village.
Yeah.
He was a regular there.
Well, I found...
He wasn't really known that way to the public, but he keeps coming up with people.
I found so many theater and opera people and film people have a different appreciation of food than food people.
They key into the storytelling element of it, correct?
They fall under the spell.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's, I think, what we all crave to do. And more and more and more, we want to get outside of ourselves and of our own realities and go somewhere memorable, wonderful.
Yes, yes.
Go enter a fantasy world.
Yes, yes.
Because God knows we need to.
Yeah. Well, it's also, that's a very benign way of expressing it. I love film. I was in the film business for 5 years. That was my childhood dream. I forget who said this. It was a director, I believe, that when you go into a theater and sit down and the lights go down, that you want to be overwhelmed.
Right.
By the film.
Right.
It's weird because in a theatrical situation, the actors are right there in the room. But a movie, it's bigger than you.
Yes.
There are effects to be made. There's camera work. You want to be sort
seduced.
Of dominated. Well, I would say even dominated by it. That could be the same thing.
Well, we are in the business of illusion.
Yes.
And seduction.
Yes.
And I think you have to work on all fronts.
Yes.
You can't just put a plate of food down in front of somebody and expect that you're going to control their life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that easy.
Yeah, right, right. So what I was going to ask you a minute ago that I alluded to was you have 3 stars here now. Now, first of all, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I know
you
wanted that for a long time.
41 years.
But, you know, what's fascinating to me is if you take Michelin at its word,
mm-hmm.
3 stars means what? They are a tire company, and it means worth a special journey.
Right.
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 Now, I was making the trip. First of all, I was looking into the different ways I might get here.
Uh-huh.
And then I was making the trip today, and then I was in the car coming from Union Station, D.C. to the end. And for people who are out there who are pondering a visit, never have come here, it's not that far. It was a 90-minute trip from Union Station.
No.
It was a pleasure, and it's a beautiful trip on a spring afternoon.
It's relaxing.
Yes.
Yes.
But what I was going to say is, I think you might be the only 3-star restaurant in the United States that actually, in the way that I know restaurants that you admired as a young man in Europe.
Right.
These restaurants, you and I spoke once on the phone about the book Great Chefs of France.
Right, right, right.
And that book is about all of the 3-star restaurants outside Paris.
Right.
It did not include the ones in the city.
Right.
And a lot of times those restaurants were the reason you would go to a town, and in some ways they were almost the reason that those towns were able to sustain themselves. And in some cases, the chefs were like, they weren't the mayor, although one of them was.
Right.
You know, you think of someone like Georges Blanc, who had a flower shop and the inn. And, I look at what you've done here.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say something like the French Laundry, but the Napa Valley is hardly off the beaten path, really. I'm not saying anything to diminish what Thomas has done there.
There are other reasons to go.
They're but you're not in the middle of nowhere. You know, if you go to Los Gatos, California, it's less than an hour from the middle of San Francisco.
Right.
I feel like this might be the restaurant in the United States that actually lives what that phrase was invented for. You're smiling big as I say this. Does that resonate with
you? Absolutely. Curiously, the restaurants you named were early inspirations. Of course, there's many stories about how I came to be here and why I am here and why I feel this is the right place for me to be and why things flourished here.
Sure.
But the direction was really galvanized by seeing the great chefs outside of Paris and in the countryside, even those in England and Ireland, where you made a pilgrimage.
Yeah.
You left your world behind and entered theirs. And it's so different than a city restaurant. You have so much more responsibility to take care of a guest.
Mm.
They don't just come in for dinner and walk out, you know.
Right, a misfire could really be a sign of real disrespect to the effort it took.
Well, you're attempting to cast a spell.
Uh-huh.
And a 24-hour spell is a hard one to pull off because a flawless period of 24 hours and controlling a staff to keep that illusion going is a huge challenge.
Yeah.
But that's what I thrive on.
Mm-hmm.
And then to keep it all evolving, you never arrive. You don't even come close.
Yes.
So about every 10 years, the staff says, well, what do you think? What do you think? Are we there yet? And I said, we're about 60% there. And they said, well, that's what you said 10 years ago. But it all keeps changing. But it has been a beautiful, beautiful journey to see how far we've come and to know that oftentimes those places in France, especially that inspired us, took three generations to get where they are.
Yeah, right.
And this has been done in one speeded up generation.
Right. What do you mean speeded up?
You know, it is life in the fast lane.
Mm-hmm. Even out here?
Well, your brain doesn't really get a chance to go to sleep.
I see what you mean. Okay. You so, like it that way, I assume. Was that the cost of attaining what you wanted, or do you like that to be that way?
I think I'm such a dreamer that if I weren't required to be on edge at all times, I might just dream myself into oblivion.
So, I have a million things I could ask you. I want to manage our time because there's a whole posse of journalists and food people coming for this little visit we have here today. But before I get to things I might ask, because I can summarize things in the intro and, you know, and say when we last left our hero, I could do that. You have been really, for someone who's been around for a while, you're having this amazing moment that seems to me to be sort of like a tuning fork. It seems to be sort of echoing, but for, a couple of years, right? You know, you've had, you gave the topic of the Welcome Conference in 2018 to Will and Brian and Anthony of, was it Restoration?
Restoration.
Yeah.
Yes.
You gave the, I think
One
it was the keynote
topics.
Speech, although it was at the end of, it was the last speech. It was, I've told you at the Beard Awards this year, where's the memoir? I mean, I'm a professional writer. I'm jealous of the way you phrase things.
Thank you.
You've done it four times in this interview already. But what I was going to say is, so you've been giving a lot of speeches. You've been giving a lot of interviews. Is there anything... I'll just give you the floor, and I'll ask follow-up. But is there anything on your mind you feel people don't get still about what you do, that you haven't found a moment to talk about, that you get off the stage after, like, the Beard Awards and think, oh, you know, I still haven't mentioned X? Is there something that you wish people understood about you, or that you feel they misunderstand about you or the N?
Well,
you have the floor.
It will be revealed in the memoir, which is...
Okay.
Very much in the works.
Great.
And startlingly enough, there is a film mm-hmm. in the works also, and a PBS documentary. So much will be revealed in that that is not known. But we're cursed by the fact that we've been in business so long, because... many people say I was there 25 years ago, believing that been there, done that, seen it, and it must be exactly the same, when in actuality, it doesn't resemble itself.
How so?
Because it has evolved. I often liken it to a tree that's grown very deep roots and is very solid.
Mm.
25 years ago, I could not leave the stove. I could not step away. I recall walking myself out of my tennis shoes at one point and getting duct tape and taping them back up so I didn't have to miss a moment, and then sending somebody to the general store
to buy you a new pair of shoes,
size 12s.
Wow.
And I can remember back in those days, the eye doctor, who was local, would examine me at the stove because I couldn't take time off. So... every waking moment, I was locked into the kitchen. Now, that's where I wanted to be. I was happy.
Sure.
But I was also escaping. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't move forward the way we are able to now, because we have a team mm-hmm. that we didn't have at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Very strong team.
Yeah.
And I feel as if some shackles have been removed. But we work against the perception that, oh, that place has been there forever. And we are not in the American mold. So an American idea of a restaurant is the hot new restaurant for the first year and a half. And then it's been there, seen it, and no reason to return, mm-hmm. and it sort of fades away. But in Europe, it's very much you build a restaurant. A 40-year-old restaurant gives you a very different kind of experience mm-hmm. than a new restaurant could. And it's important that people understand the difference, especially if they can find a restaurant that has continued to evolve yeah. over 40 years.
Yeah.
So we're essentially an anomaly in this culture today,
yeah.
and people don't understand that. They don't understand what motivates you to keep making it better, why you would want to do that if, you know, you're financially sound and viable. Mm-hmm. What inspires you to make it better? So they also think, if they've ever been here or known somebody who's been here, they've got it. But I think we are now entering a period where we can deliver an experience that is mm-hmm. unparalleled in America.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a bold statement.
Well, and I'm not...
You just looked at me so matter-of-factly and just shook your head yes, and...
I'm not inclined
What's
to
the problem with that?
overly sort of bold about who we are, yeah. but I think the world is catching up.
Mm-hmm.
I think what happens is that every year we become more rarefied.
Yeah.
And people only when they come and contrast the feeling they have here,
yeah.
do they realize, oh my God, there's no comparison very often.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we don't have brilliant, exciting chefs coming up all the time doing wonderful, outrageous, stimulating things, but to give somebody a complete restorative charge
yeah.
And take them to a place where everything is at the same level.
Yeah.
Is not out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So welcome to Little Washington.
That's fascinating. What's it like for you being where you are geographically? Do you tend to hold on to people front of house and kitchen for a long time because they want to be here, feel an attachment, feel an investment in what you in your particular mission? Or is this a place, and the answer might be both, obviously, but is this a place where people come, spend a year, stage, and then head for the hill? Well, head away from the hills, head to the skyscrapers. What's it like for you on that front?
Well, someone who will flourish here has to love living in Sleepy Hollow mm-hmm. utopia.
Yeah.
And understand the value of that.
Yeah.
And if they do, and if they begin to raise a family, they don't have any desire to leave.
Yeah.
So our senior dining room person has been here 26 years, and his five sons all work here.
All five?
All five.
Oh, my God.
And
Are they all in the front? Are they all in the dining room?
One goes in and out of the kitchen, but for the most part, they're all in the dining
wow.
room. Even if they're at college, one is. They come home on the weekends.
So did I just meet coming in the gentleman I think named Brad and maybe help me with
Brad is second generation.
He's second generation.
Yeah, his father
oh,
what was
my
here.
Gosh.
Bob, who you met, Bob
yeah,
Fass,
yeah, yeah.
his son is here. His two sons both work
oh,
here.
Oh my gosh.
So you have to understand how wonderful living here is to know. For me, the greatest luxury is space and peace
mm-hmm.
and safety
yeah.
and security.
Yeah.
And all of that is here.
Mm-hmm.
And it provides an antidote to the stresses of working here.
Mm-hmm.
So we can have a Saturday night where all hell is breaking loose and, oh my God, this VIP is here and that VIP and we're surrounded by security and this is going on and your brain is about to explode. And you put it all to bed and you step outside and you just hear the crickets and maybe a tree frog. And you begin to think, did I dream all that? Or
right.
did that really go on tonight?
Right. Yeah.
You know, were there three, you know, presidential candidates all in the same room and two Supreme Court justices and mm-hmm. all of this? And you step outside and the real world awaits you.
Mm.
And you go home and maybe you sit on your porch for a while
yeah.
and you pet your dog and
yeah.
It's just heavenly.
Do you have a dog?
Of course I have a dog.
Of course.
I'm wearing his spots, our Dalmatian mascot. You'll meet him tonight.
Okay.
He's a heartthrob.
Okay.
We rescued Dalmatians.
Oh, nice.
And he was rescued from the next town over the mountain, which is named Luray, where the Luray Caverns are. So his name is Luray.
Got it.
So that he'll never forget his humble origins. But he performs.
Okay.
He was just captured in a giant portrait of me and him.
Oh, I saw that.
Oh, you saw it, yeah.
Where would I have seen
Probably
that?
The Washington Post did a piece
okay,
on
Okay, that's
it.
For, yeah. Oh, yeah. Or maybe even on social media.
And that came out of nowhere. The artist had never painted a chef before.
Okay.
And really wanted to tell a story and create a narrative.
Right.
So I happened to have an old throne here.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why. I buy odd things when I can. And so we set it up in a meadow, which you'll see this afternoon, called the Field of Dreams, named by the staff. And it was in the middle of the field. And wouldn't you think naturally I would sit in it, but we decided we wanted it to be lighthearted and playful. So Luray, the dog, sat in the throne, and I sat on the chair, on the edge, on the arm, and we communed a little bit. And he was able to capture this meadow behind us and mystical light.
Yeah.
So I named it The Heir Apparent. And then for the unveiling, where we had all the big wigs from D.C. here, he's painted some influential political figures, our governor.
Sure.
And he has portraits in the National Portrait Gallery with the presidents. So the ultimate goal is that this will find its way into the National Portrait Gallery. Mm.
Doesn't seem unrealistic.
No,
I'm going to knock
on
wood.
When you see it, it's beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful
no, that
painting.
Seems reasonable.
For the unveiling, Luray wore angel wings.
Yeah,
and you could have your picture taken in the throne with Luray.
Yes.
So it was a fun afternoon.
Does the dog thing go? Did you have a dog? Was that go back to childhood? Have you always had dogs? Or a dog?
You know, when I grew up, you usually had an old hound dog that hung outside the back door and you threw a pork chop bone occasionally at it.
So it wasn't like man's best friend and you hung out?
No,
and,
you just somehow, we had, you know, six kids and somebody would bring home a stray.
Okay.
So then we had a manager who was a dog person, and his thought was that I was not that well anchored in reality. And if I had a dog, it might calm me. And I thought, is he out of his mind or what? But I just fell in love with having somebody to go home to who you
could
talk to.
Well, you know, I'm a writer.
Uh-huh.
And I had a dog years ago, a mini Australian Shepherd.
Uh-huh.
And it made all the difference to me. And I was, I don't know if you know WeWork. It's one of these communal office companies for people who don't have. So I live in the burbs outside of New York City. I had a space at WeWork where I would go and write. And then we got a dog last year because our kids wanted a dog. And we didn't want another dog. We have kids. But I gave up the WeWork because I love being at home writing with my dog under my feet. And I love going for, I live in the burbs. I can go for a hike on the trail for lunch. You know, that's my lunchtime.
Right, right.
It's the greatest thing.
Having somebody always excited about seeing you.
Oh, my gosh.
And so happy when you're home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's our moment when we go out for our midnight walk. And he romps and rolls in the grass. And fortunately, he loves children. He likes other dogs. And he's good with guests. Mm-hmm. And he's very fond of little girls because he lived with one at one time.
Okay.
So we couldn't ask for anything more except that he's a bit territorial around his toys.
Do you get a growl if you get near the toys?
You're not allowed in the house. So he dictates who he will let in his house and who he won't.
And you defer. And you defer.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's okay.
But
he's there more than you are.
He is. It is definitely his house. When he came, clearly he'd never had a toy.
Yeah.
So he still favors his very first toy.
Yeah.
And now he has two toy chests.
You know, you brought up something a minute ago. You mentioned the portrait and you mentioned the throne.
Yes.
You know, for all of the things about this place that all, I mean, I haven't had the full tour yet. I literally got here, took the fastest shower I ever took in my life.
Jeez.
And then came to see you at the appointed hour.
Oh, my God.
It's fine.
Okay.
I like.
All right.
I pride myself on being prompt. But
there's 40 years here you haven't seen.
What I was going to say is, I knew it from things I've seen and read. One thing that you do bring to this place, you mentioned the throne,
you mentioned the portrait with your dog, not a portrait of you looking imperious in your whites, you and a dog, is a sense of humor.
Yes.
Now, this is something that people for, I don't know what restaurant, maybe one or two of them, but most of the old, great, three-star Michelin restaurants of France, you think of a lot of things when you think of them. You don't think sense of humor. You don't even particularly think, except for maybe the you know, the maitre d' coming by your table and pretending to laugh at your jokes. You don't even particularly think of laughter.
So well said.
But you've added that to, you just said something I said was well said?
Absolutely.
I'm so happy.
I really believe that that was one of the major contributions that American chefs provided for fine dining. The ability not only to enjoy the experience fully, to be yourself, but to be playful. And just two nights ago, there was a group of people dining in the kitchen, and the man said to me, "We've stopped going to three-star restaurants." And I said, "What?" He said, "We've been to them all. We simply don't enjoy it anymore. It's so uptight, and it's so formal, and it's so stiff, and that's just not us."
And they kill you with food.
Yeah. And he said, "But we came here, and we immediately felt we could be ourselves, and there were no rules. And then your entire staff is keyed into that, and everybody was having a good time." I said, "Well, you know, we do have one rule with our staff, and that is they are not allowed to have more fun than the guests. And if they do, they will be fined a quarter." But it happens almost every night. I have to remind them that they're having more fun than the guests. So my sense is that if we're not having fun, they can detect that. So if they sense that we're thoroughly enjoying ourselves doing what we're doing, which we must do in order to do it all these years, that gives them a great feeling of comfort and reassurance that we love it and we love making them happy. We love, but you can't treat every guest the same way. You can't treat every party the same way. And this is where the great chains fail us.
Great chains. I'm not going to ask you to put anyone down, but at what level do you mean great
chains?
Well,
I mean the great luxury chains that have a very ingrained philosophy of ladies taking care of ladies and gentlemen or whatever. Ladies and gentlemen caring for other ladies and gentlemen. They have wonderful philosophies and theories, but they attempt to apply them to every single individual.
Yeah.
And like stand-up or theater, you have to adapt to your audience every minute, every second.
I love that analogy.
Every table is different.
Karen Waltuck of the late, great Chanterelle restaurant, who had no formal training, came along with her husband on the adventure of being in the restaurant business, became a very important figure in on the front of the house, in service in this country. The original Chanterelle, which was on the corner of Grand and Green in Soho.
Enjoyed it much.
Her line, I never got to eat at that one.
Her
line about that restaurant was 10 tables, 10 worlds.
10 worlds?
Yes.
Yes.
That was her, the way, that was how she explained it to her staff. And the other thing was they would take on people who had never worked in a restaurant before.
Those are the best.
And her line was, you can teach hospitality, you can't teach smart. But the point was that I could think of places I would put on the list. I'm not going to list them right now, but because a lot of them are great restaurant companies. But employees oftentimes either aren't empowered to, or they're incapable of making decisions in the moment. And it's like you spoke at the Welcome Conference, something that I think Will Goddard has been so amazing at teaching his, or letting his people do. I don't even know that it's something that's taught. Trusting that you've hired well, this person gets my values. Now I'm going to let them be a human and interact in a different way with each of these other humans they're caring for. This is what you're saying.
One of our staff asked me, "What do you want most from us?" And I said, "I want you to feel that you can always be yourself. We don't want you to play act waiter or play act fancy restaurant or something like that. We want you to interact with the guests as though these were members of your family or friends in a genuine, friendly way. So we can't program you. We can't give you a script. We can teach you what's in the dishes, but
or where the flatware goes, or glass for what wine.
But in the moment, you have to learn how to determine who wants no interaction and who wants you to be their new best friend and find some happy medium. Yeah. If an ambassador is entertaining three heads of state, you're going to treat them a little differently than a young couple who's wooing each other or somebody who's celebrating their 25th anniversary here. Yeah. We find a lot of older married people are desperate for somebody to be a participant observer in their experience, and they want a child, and they want to adopt these wonderful, bright young people, and they want to spend the night with them. Other people are exactly the opposite.
They're not. They haven't heard all of each other's jokes and stories
exactly,
yet.
Yeah, exactly. But we see these couples who haven't had a good time in 10 years just feeling as though they found a new family.
Yeah, right.
And that's what we want. So I always say every night, they're expecting a great meal. They're expecting perfect service. They're expecting a beautiful ambiance. But what they're really craving, secretly coming here for, is to make a human connection that is lacking in other spheres of their life. Oh. Oh, thank you. Oh, sweet. Thank you.
What is that they just put in front of you?
I have to take my sunglasses off to see it.
It's a miniature coconut Bavarian.
Okay.
The very core is a passion fruits.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it's a little bit of passion fruit pearls are on top as well as pressed pineapple.
You're going to have a little taste later. Thank you. But these are the little magic sweet caviars that we...
Nice.
Anyway.
So you just named two things that help you achieve a certain goal, right? One is sense of humor. The other is letting people be themselves. What else do you feel like you do here that falls into that same sort of umbrella category, if there is anything else?
Well, there are many things. We have certain tools that we've developed of necessity over the years, over the many years. My belief is that we really only have one problem on Earth, and that is communication. Mm-hmm. So every night at the staff lineup, I say, and can anybody tell me the only problem we have here? It's always communication. So,
is this a film reference, an accidental film reference? Do you know what I'm referring to? Do you remember Cool Hand Luke?
No, but Paul Newman was here for his 65th
birthday. Well, Cool Hand Luke, the famous line right before they throw him in the box was, what we have here is a failure to communicate.
Ah, good. Good.
That was the prison warden or whoever it was. Yeah.
Well, to help facilitate that, we have some simple little tools. One is the mood indicator. And each guest is assigned a mood rating of 1 to 10 by their front waiter on being seated, which forces the front waiter into focusing on them, analyzing where they are, and then he plugs it in numerically into the computer system, and it's tracked. The goal being that no matter how upset, angry, or irritated somebody might be on arrival, collectively as a team, we can bring them up.
Yeah.
So talk about an empowering exercise.
Sure.
Typically, of course, a normal restaurant will say, oh, don't go near table 12. They're having some kind of spat. It has nothing to do with us. They're just, she's bitching him out, and he hates her, and they're going to get a divorce. So just stay clear of them. We do the opposite. We say, okay, we need to bring up that mood. It was only a 6.5. First of all, what happened? Why did they come all the way out here and find themselves in a crappy mood? Well, they got a speeding ticket. They got a flat tire. They had a fight on the way. They got lost. Any of these things can happen. So a normal waiter would say, it has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with us. because here we got 150 people trying to give them the experience of their life and getting them to come back. They'll never come back if they had a miserable time. So I say, by saying that we gave them perfect service, we gave them perfect food, and they left unhappy, is like saying the operation was a success, but the patient died. Yeah. It's exactly the same scenario. Yeah. So we love cranky, mean, horrible people who have a reason to be upset, and we just say, yes, bring them on.
To put it in athletic terms, you want the ball. You guys want the ball. You're willing to throw the pass at I don't follow anything but tennis, but you're willing to throw the pass at last play of the game, 1 second left. If you don't make
those
the touch, if you don't make the touchdown, it's
those
all over.
Best.
You would be the person who would have you
those
would you want that pressure.
The ultimate experience along those lines was they came to me. If they can't get a read on the guest, they always bring them into the kitchen. And then I pull out of them their story. So in order to facilitate this kind of communication, this connection, everyone has a story. It's our job to get them to voice that story during the 2.5 hours they're here. And they will and they want to, but they're just not going to give it to anyone. They have to give it to somebody who's totally receptive and who really wants to hear it and who's interested. And when they sense that, they will just pour it out. Mm-hmm. So one night they said, table 12, he told her he wanted a divorce during the meal. And they don't know what's going to happen at this point. It's just a mess.
It's like the opposite of like proposing to somebody.
Exactly.
Did you have a waiter come and take the ring away?
No. There wasn't a ring. They had already been married.
No, I'm saying, but it was the opposite. Like usually you come to a restaurant like this to propose.
Oh, you do. Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
But this was the exact opposite.
So that actually required me to go out and say, we fully understand. And that's great that you've made this decision. But you're here now. And all of us would love to give you a wonderful, wonderful dinner. And perhaps you'd just like to think of it as one last beautiful meal together. And, like, cut the crap.
Right.
And that was a bit ballsy to enter into their sphere.
Totally. And?
But they looked at me like, you know, you've got a point.
Yeah.
And then it was like, why should we fight in such a wonderful place when everyone is conspiring to make us happy? Why not just let ourselves be happy for a little while?
Yeah. And well, to me, this goes back to what you said about communication.
Right.
Right. This
right.
was a, like for right. themselves. This is to, that's probably, that's, I mean, couples, especially, I mean, communication, you feel like you're not being seen. You feel like someone's not hearing you. You feel like,
well,
how could I be right? They don't after this long. Don't you know how I work yet? You know, I think that's what a lot of that's why there's like these hair triggers you see with couples a lot. That's how they could come to a place like this and have that happen.
Well, we have the other scenario where, especially with guest rooms, they have a pattern where they need to have this little spat so they can go upstairs and make up.
Okay, that's honest.
You learn a lot about people.
Oh, I'm
business.
Sure. Well, especially at the end. Okay. This may. I don't know how to ask this question. I've only seen you ever publicly. I've never seen you in your kitchen. You've got this amazing laugh. Mm. You were very. I mean, maybe only Bud Collins in the history has rivaled your pants in terms of. You know who Bud Collins was?
No.
He was a tennis writer. He always did coverage from Wimbledon, and he would wear a blazer and a button-down, and then he would have like these bright – you guys could have had the same wardrobe and pants, right? But anyway, you know, you have this great laugh. You have very – I can't see them right now, but we've spoken before. You have very intense eyes, very intense. Your chef jacket is perfect. What's your management style like? Is it different from this jovial, joking. I mean, I think in some respects it must be, but I'm just curious. Is there a different Patrick O'Connell in the back of the house? If that's an okay question.
Of course it's an okay question. There is a level of intensity that is probably extreme, but it is subtle. So it's felt. You don't have to holler or raise your voice.
You've mastered being able to get what you want with a look or with silence, maybe.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. So if somebody's going to come into the kitchen or whatever and somebody's area or station is a mess, I just make my fingers into the shape of a camera and I just zero in on them and they scurry.
Yeah.
And that just says it all. Is this what you want your world to look like?
Right.
And I have to remind them continuously that people are photographing the food in close-up, and I'll do the same with that.
Sure.
And you have a sixth sense about every aspect of the place. You walk in and you don't know why. You have no clue why instinctively you walked to one area of the kitchen and you look down and you say, you know, what is this? And you think, what made me walk over there to find out that this wasn't right at all? Or you run up to room 9 and you think, it's been, I haven't seen room 9 in 3 days. I better check that out. And you go and you think, holy Christ, who put this in this room? All wrong. And it doesn't belong in here. And so they know that if there is something amiss, you're going to find it. And you're... your job is to find it before the guest, the critic, or the writer does. So it becomes a game. It's quite exciting, actually.
You enjoy that part of it.
It's tedious.
But looking at it, well, this goes to the, this is like similar to what you said about taking the pretension out of the dining experience. If you look at it as a game, even though it's deadly serious,
Well, life
then
is
it
a
doesn't
game.
Becomes it doesn't, but it doesn't become a misery for you. It, it kind of, I imagine, it keeps it from becoming sort of you the thing you do with the lens that you just mimicked, and you probably feel a little better about yourself at the end of the day than if you were losing control.
Oh,
that's
absolutely
a very controlled way of achieving a result that some people, especially of your generation, to this day achieve by lung power.
Right, right.
Accurate?
Yes, yes. There was a period when I had to wonder if these young boys didn't not only expect to be hollered at, but didn't secretly crave being hollered at.
I think a lot of them do. I think they want what they got from their high school football coach.
They think that that's part of what a commercial kitchen is supposed to be. So it was an adjustment when I found out they wanted to be punished and chastised and all of this. So we sort of turned it around. And I just couldn't go there.
Yeah.
So we give hugs now when somebody really screws up really bad.
Literally, you do?
Yeah. So
that's so parental. That's I would describe that as parental.
Well, I think my style changes with my age. Early on, I was the crazed chef who never had enough sleep, and no one could do anything right because they had no. They were all country kids with no training or whatever, and you were frustrated.
And your fate was in their hands.
Yeah.
Your dream. Yeah. I mean, to use your word, your dream.
Well, so now if somebody is having a really terrible night, you realize you're going to make it worse if you lay anything more on them. And you just, usually now I'll get them a little something to eat. And they think, my God, he just gave me my favorite dish.
So, okay, food. Let's talk about food for a minute. I have a couple of questions for you. Well, here's what's amazing to me. You know, for all these people, you know, of your generation of American chefs who grew up idolizing, you know, these Michelin restaurants, and not just the 3 stars, but, you know, these French chefs, right?
The feeling of those. The, yeah.
Okay. I mean, almost nobody's achieved it here of that generation. Even, well, not many people have achieved it of younger generations. But what I was going to say is, you know, I'm, as you know, I have a real curiosity, fascination, affection for this time that I wasn't around for. And you just said they were these country kids. They didn't really know how to cook back in the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a real shortage of cooks. We were just starting to mint cooks in this country, right? And the thing I once jokingly said to somebody, but it wasn't really a joke, that I was on an airplane and they had live television and I saw MasterChef Junior, one of these shows. And I said to someone, you know, I just saw this show up in the sky that I'd never seen. And I'm sorry, those kids could have worked at Le Cote Basque in 1983, you know? And the person laughed. I said, but I'm not, I don't think I'm kidding. Like, you know, I've often wondered back then, even food that was getting well reviewed. I'm not talking about yours, just so I'm clear.
Right.
But I've often wondered, like, was it great what we were doing here? I mean, I understand the ideas were great, but there was the execution was so subject to this very limited workforce. You know, if you talk to someone like Alfred Portale, the reason he developed that style at the Gotham was to keep young cooks who couldn't. From taking things into their own hands.
Right.
He had been a jewelry designer.
Right.
So that was his solution, but it was to make it into these interlocking pieces.
Right.
So nobody could mess it up.
Right.
Right? It became this accidental signature style.
Exactly.
But he did it for survival.
Of course.
Does this resonate with you at
absolutely.
All? Can you help illuminate this, my understanding of this topic?
Consistency was one of the great challenges of that day. You could show someone exactly how you wanted it and watch them butcher it. And so I had to understand that it takes a normal human about a month to get something right.
Okay.
Consistently. So if you expect that it won't be right for a month, you won't be as frustrated.
Yeah.
But what the journalists responded to in the early days was our enthusiasm, our energy, our freshness. And we had a woman journalist come, and she said she'd just dined at three-star restaurants in Paris. And everything was perfect and perfectly boring.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that's pretty tough. But here, by contrast, nothing was boring because it was full of surprises. It was full of risk-taking. Now, did it always work? No, we were experimenting. But we weren't charging you accordingly.
And so if you were doing it in like a box score, if you were judging something on points, you got extra points for that factor, where maybe you lost a point or two on the technical piece.
Right.
Yeah. If we so were it leveled
competing
out. It leveled
in
out.
Beaucoup d'Or or something like that, I'm self-taught.
Yeah.
Obviously, imagine the mistakes I had to make to learn to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But yet this creativity, curiosity, and bringing together what I had to work with here was so new and so fresh that people responded. So my sense always is that people go toward an energy field. We're like wild creatures or insects, really. And we can sense where high energy is. And we want to go there.
Moths to a flame.
That's right. We want to be part of it.
Yeah.
And this is why most older restaurants fade and die. They can't sustain that intense energy because you have to create some newness every day.
Mm-hmm.
So every day when I walk in, something has to be new. It doesn't have to be limited to just the food. One piece or part of the experience has to be new. I have to see newness and progress.
And is this something you dictate, or is this something you look to your team to take the initiative to provide?
I push them toward it. And I recall having a writing teacher who said to me, if you're not embarrassed by what you wrote last year, you're not progressing.
Oh, yeah.
And so, fortunately, we're mortified by everything we did last week, as it should be.
That's a great philosophy. Well, I think it's great.
I have to tell new people when they come here, if you are the kind of person who wants every day, every year, to be kind of the same and come in, know what to expect, and just repeat the same things over and over, you probably aren't going to like it here. Right. But if you're someone who wants to be challenged, who wants to always be pushed to create the next thing, and sometimes under pressure, you might really thrive here.
So that perfectly anticipates the next thing I wanted to ask you, which was, again, if you go to your initial frame of reference, I know Bocuse was a big, big thing for you, as he was for a lot of people. You can go right now to that restaurant. He's not even with us anymore.
Right.
And have sort of what I call the greatest hits menu, that the grand, whatever they call it.
Right.
Probably the same menu that you could have had when you went there for the first time.
In 78.
I'm being completely, for people who have never been, most people probably haven't. Right. I was lucky to get there once, but I'm being literal.
Right.
I am the Rouget with the potato scales, the VGE soup with the puff pastry on top and the foie gras inside, all that stuff. That's all you can order. That's part of a menu. That's all on a menu there still, right? Now, what you just said to me in many ways seems to be on the complete opposite end of the spectrum from something like that. How married are you to your own classics? How much do you want to have them be cycled back or come back around? How do you balance keeping fresh with honoring, you know, a fairly... an amazingly established reputation and already, even as you still sit here, a legacy that's incredible. How do you walk that line? Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. In fact, one of the three menus we offer was called Enduring Classics, but we even changed that. But we, it's very simple. You take what is the expected classic dish, and you say, how can I make it better? It never really arrives in your mind. So it's going through an evolutionary process, even as the guest thinks you should never change a thing. So 30 years ago, guests would leave and they would say things like, partiate it.
What?
That's Southern for appreciate it.
Oh, okay.
You knew you were in the South.
Right.
They would say, well, I enjoyed it, partiate it. You'd think, what? But and then they would say, it's so good, don't ever change a thing. Don't change a thing. And the minute the door would close, you'd think, I'm going to change everything before you come back.
Right.
So you can take a dish that you've honed, but if... hopefully you'll get bored with that dish and like an act or whatever, you'll want to rework it, rethink it, reconfigure it, use it in a different way, or maybe let it lie fallow.
Do you have any sense of what sorts of, because that's you. I know other people like that. Paul Liebrandt, who was the chef at Cortone years ago, he just would retire dishes. You know, he would do
it. Oh, sure, you have. And the more they like
it. And then gone.
If they like it too much. One night I was in the corner and the little table in the corner, table 12. I heard there were two businessmen, and one said, you've been here before? Oh, many times. What's good? And he said, the oysters. And the other man said, what else? And he said, I don't know. I just always order the oysters. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, that's it. Tomorrow those oysters are off the menu. And I thought, how weird. You have to get them to try other things. You know, you can't get them locked into a groove.
But what I was going to ask was, you know, then you have people like, I mean, the person who immediately comes to mind is Andre Soltner, who had La Tasse, who was perfectly happy to come in for 40 years and make the terrine and... You know, it was almost like time to make the donuts with him, you know? I mean, he was satisfied doing that. But I was going to ask if you have any insight. I do think these are two very different types of chefs.
They are.
And probably this applies to other disciplines, creative pursuits as well, right?
Yeah. Well, if you regard it as performance art, which it is, and your audience is changing... you have to be mindful of that. And even the last time I was in Paris, a couple of weeks ago, at the recommendation of the former director of Guide Michelin, I went to one of the favorite three-star restaurants that had not changed in 30 years. Yeah. And we tried to involve the waiter in planning a menu for three of us, and we wanted to taste the maximum number of dishes. So we ordered a few extra things. But the plates came, and shockingly, the portions were gargantuan mm-hmm. by today's standards. And there was no way you could happily eat everything on that plate mm-hmm. and be still wanting more. So we thought, how weird that even the portion size, no one wants to eat this way anymore. And it was fine in 1959, mm-hmm. even in 1963, but not now. So just by being mindful of the changes in how we live, mm-hmm. a little adjustment. In other words, as preposterous as it sounds, as egocentric, I had the feeling that if I just went in and spent an hour with the chef, modified here and there a little bit, he could just go soaring into another orbit where people would appreciate what he was doing more.
Now, would you have ever, as a young person, idolizing what was happening over there and being someone from here with the where we were culinarily, have imagined that you could have a moment like that as an adult? That's an amazing... You know, I asked Keller once if he could have ever imagined he'd be over in France with the winning team of the Bocuse d'Or. And he said, never in a million years.
Yeah.
Never in a million years as an American of that era.
Yeah. What I learned and felt from the French that was lacking here was any reverence or sacredness about the experience, about their approach to food. Mm. And that was the most significant aspect for me. Mm-hmm. And I still feel that we have a ways to go here in appreciating.
Here at the end here in America?
Here in America. Okay. Here in America. And that is still the difference in the two cultures.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. Can I ask... You know, I've seen you around. You're on the road a lot. You just said you were in Paris.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not 25 years old. You seem very, you know, you seem very loose-limbed and energetic and spry. Is this all just a product of running this place, or do you have a regimen outside of here? Are you a walker? Are you a
what do you do? I work with a trainer 3 days a week.
Oh, you do?
Sure.
For
sure,
how long
sure.
now?
25 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it?
It's essential. It works as much for me mentally as it does physically. So it keeps you somewhat lean. It clears your mind. Mm-hmm. Very often in this business, it can all weigh on you to the point that you are overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Very easy to get overwhelmed.
And almost claustrophobic, right? Or emotionally claustrophobic.
Yeah. Well, the beauty of what I do, though, is that if you OD on food or the kitchen, you just shift your focus to a restoration project on an old building nearby, and you get excited about that, and you take a break.
Yeah.
Or you go into the gardens, mm-hmm. and you start worrying the gardener.
Right.
So there's many arenas to play in.
Yes.
But you have to be definitely able to move around quickly.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That has been a real lifesaver for me.
That's
Plus,
great.
I have an instinctive sense of what my body needs to eat at any given moment.
Really? So you don't get to the point of starvation, you just...
Well, in the early days, I did.
But I
couldn't eat until midnight in the early days because I was too high strung.
You were one of these, like, espresso in the morning,
It was 12 to 13
dinner after
cups
service.
A day.
Yeah.
And then you can't sleep.
Yep.
So it was a terrible... So I modified that and brought it into a balance. But now fully understand that if you listen very closely, your body will tell you exactly what is right for you at any moment. And if people could sort of clue into that more, I think we'd be less dependent on wacky diets and listening to other people tell us what we should eat and what we shouldn't eat.
Right.
And your body also knows, like in animals, just how much you should eat.
And I think what you should eat.
Oh, yeah, what you should eat.
There are times when I can't explain it. You're craving some red meat.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I would bet at that moment you need some iron.
Exactly. Absolutely.
It's not just some guilty pleasure you're after. It's not like you're some slob who needs a burger. Your body, you probably have some, your blood, you know, your iron level's probably a little down.
And the joy of owning a restaurant is that you can have someone make you whatever 24 hours a day.
Right.
And you can have it picked out of the garden and it can come in and you realize, you know, heads of state are not eating this well. And, if you go to the White House, you'll think, oh, my God, I'm glad I don't have to eat here, just on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You can actually go out here and graze in the garden.
Yeah.
And it's, you can eat the medicinal herbs. Yeah. It's pretty wonderful.
When you, I've seen you speak and you have this line that I absolutely love. I don't have it in front of me, but I'll paraphrase it. It's something like, do you know what I'm going to say?
That everybody has a place in the universe.
Yes.
Yeah.
That if you're lucky, you will find the place in the universe where you are supposed to be.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you say it? You've said it publicly enough times. You must know it like know it like a script.
Well, bear in mind that it's a very foreign concept to the way people move around today, the way they live, the way they think. Everything we do is dictated toward money and career.
Mm-hmm.
And so that trumps every other aspect of our lives. But if you allow yourself, just as when we sat down, you asked me where I wanted to sit. This is my spot.
This is your preferred spot in the entire restaurant?
No, well, this is usually where I have dinner.
Okay.
But this is the seat at this table where I am most comfortable, as opposed to that seat. So, I mean, I can sit there. I can do an interview there. But if people made a conscious effort to tune in just a little bit more about where they feel good, where their happy spot is, they would be surprised. And unfortunately, some people wait until they're retiring to begin searching out where they where they feel best.
Yeah.
But I find that people are either water people or they're mountain people. So the water makes me feel very lonely and very insignificant. Right. So, I mean, I might like it if I was in a hotel looking out on it for a short while, but I wouldn't want to live there. I also find
you might want to just walk out into it one day and it does not come back.
Well, you feel that it's going to wash over you.
You're just going to
be taken.
Yes.
But yet there are people who have to live near water.
Yes.
And that's important for them. Here, I have this comfort of these rolling hills cosseting me all around, and I feel protected, I feel nurtured, I feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're a person who is wary of the world, and who shouldn't be, you have to find your safe spot also.
Mm-hmm.
So you can observe this in pets or in animals. If you let a dog into the room, a strange room, it will circle the room three times before it determines where it's going to lie down.
Mm-hmm.
It's a spot, the spot in that room where it's most comfortable.
Yeah, it's like a spiritual feng shui.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. In a way.
Yeah.
But if you find it hook, line, and sinker, as I did when I came here, this, you breathe differently. You're exhilarated.
Yeah.
There is my first shack was down a 3-mile dirt road at the base of a mountain, and you saw no, as we call them out here, outsiders ever. It was more like a hermitage.
Mm.
And when you got there, you felt you could totally be yourself, and you would sacrifice quite a lot in order to have that moment or that feeling.
Yeah.
So anyone who walks into the woods here or up on the Appalachian Trail breathes differently, they carry their body differently, they think differently, more clearly. So I was the kind of person living in a city who was excited and stimulated by everything around me. I couldn't walk down a block without, God, I'd like to go in there. Geez, the Chinese store. Oh, right. Wow.
I'm going to buy three magazines at this newsstand.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And it was like, I couldn't even remember where I was headed. I'm still that way.
Yeah.
I'm still that way.
Yeah.
So today, I don't know which room I walked into. Ah, maybe it was the little house you're staying in. We restored it for the third time. But I walked in the little lobby downstairs, and there was a stillness, and it cast a spell, and everything was in the right place. And actually, that's pretty rare in life today when someone who is a control freak and is concerned about every detail can just go, yes. So when you step out into the forest, you don't want to change a thing. It's exactly how it's supposed to be. So that's part of the restorative experience that we're able to offer here.
Have you always been at peace? I don't know how to, I'm just going to phrase it. I'm not going to hurt your feelings.
No.
You know, I've been around the last several months at a bunch of festivals, and I was all excited I was coming here. I promised you 2 years ago I was going to come here with my kids. I didn't do it, mainly because I can't get my son to even go to, like, you know, the supermarket with me. He's a teenager. But that was the main reason why it never happened. You know, I don't want to like out them on the show, but I would talk to people. Oh, you know, that restaurant, I always wanted to get out there. And I'm talking about chefs who themselves have stars.
Right.
People who've a lot of these people were in California because I was out there.
Right.
But people who trained in New York had their formative years in New York.
Sure.
I myself, you know, have never been here. I'm embarrassed to say that. I feel like it's not okay in some level. But you know what? There's a lot of people who fall into this category.
Yes.
I'm wondering what it took for you to stay the course, to know that this is where you belonged, to know that it would bear fruit, to know that you could continue to draw people here. I mean, my God, you just got the three, you know, it's not that long ago. You just got the Michelin star. You got this huge primo speaking spot, you know, at that big conference at Lincoln Center. After all these years, nobody in this country has this level at this after that many years. They really don't. It's kind of a miracle, but I'm wondering if it was hard. Well, miracle suggests that there wasn't a lot of work behind it. I mean, you built it, but they don't always come, right? Like, if you build it, they will come. A lot of people didn't come and still haven't. Is that hard for you? Does that upset you? Is that something you've had to learn to live with and not? You have a look on your face that I cannot read.
There was,
you look very amused by the question.
Absolutely.
Is it a dumb question?
No.
I'm wondering what it took. It just personally, not business, not investing, not staffing out here where we are. Just what it took for you on a spiritual level to stay the course out here. It's a huge moral accomplishment, it seems to me. I don't think many people could do it. I really don't. I think at some point they would say, oh, you want to give me a restaurant in New York City? Yes, I'll do it. And I'll be in all these articles and I'll be on television. Well,
firstly, I never really think of it as a restaurant.
Okay.
It's more like running a country house.
Yep, fair enough.
With a big staff. Mm-hmm. And it's my home.
Yes.
And it's where I live and where I've chosen to live and where I need to live and where I must continue to live in order to survive. And I'll do whatever is required and sacrifice whatever I need to sacrifice in order to have the luxury of being here. It does... Well, annoy is a strong word, but annoys me sometimes that people will go to a mountaintop in Barcelona or to Chile or to run over to some inaccessible place to experience the next flash in the pan and they've always thought maybe they'd come here, right. But there's a reason they don't. Yeah. You know what the reason is? They're not ready.
Have you given that answer before?
Never.
Never?
Never.
No, for real.
Never.
Because I
for
thought
real.
that question just, never. As we were sitting here, that never. Question has been like swelling in my head.
Never.
And that
no, no,
would,
no.
You're
no,
just that
no,
eloquent.
No,
okay. Well, you
not
should,
ready.
You know, I'm not, I
which
can't,
is,
I'm not
okay.
going to be able to write
but,
after this.
But this is the downside.
Yeah.
They know it's romantic.
Yes.
They, if it's a woman journalist, for example, she's divorced and she's waiting
yeah.
for the right guy.
Yes.
If it's not work related, mm-hmm. this place. Mm-hmm. This place is submersive. And it maybe takes people somewhere that they're not sure they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's very intimate in a
mm-hmm.
way. And it's not like just putting the notch on your belt
yeah.
of having gone to El Bulli or one of the places out there. It's not trying to be that. It's, but
yeah.
the annoyance comes from this is an integral, important part of our American culture
mm-hmm.
to not just support, but to embrace and appreciate a place such as this.
Mm-hmm.
If you want there to be any more, or if you want this to be a component to what people call fine dining,
mm.
or do you just want successive new restaurants opening daily in all the major cities that you will flock to
mm-hmm.
and forget about tomorrow. What is rewarding for us is a more important audience sometimes is the second and third generation of families who've been coming here and celebrating major milestone occasions.
Mm.
And now the grandchildren are coming. And a boy in the kitchen the other night was dining and he said, "Chef, do you know the first time I came here, how old I was?" And I said, "No, how old?" And he said, "I was 5. And now I'm proposing tonight to my,
my
lady
gosh.
Friend." And so we truly have third generation families who've been coming and they get it and understand it and it has a place in their lives.
Mm.
So people often in the food media world are looking for news.
Mm.
They're required to look for news, and excellence is not news.
No.
Consistency is not news.
Yeah.
Yet in France, for example, it would be revered. It would have attached to it a sort of sacredness.
Yes.
We don't have that.
Right.
We don't have that.
Yeah.
So instead it's 40 years, my God, you know, is it clean?
Well, there is also I think we have to stop it.
Okay.
I've been getting a little...
Oh, well.
Everyone's being very subtle about it, but I may have overdone it. I hope I'm
no,
not...
No. We're just getting warmed up.
But no, what I wanted to say to you was, I think there is also... You know, I came in here today, you know, somebody was painting a fence. I want to... one of your pieces of property.
Uh-huh.
The place is being maintained,
oh my God.
Right? But
oh.
I think the idea, it's the Inn at Little Washington. It's in Virginia. It must be dilapidated.
Really?
And, well, I think people must think that, you know, because of geography. And in this place, I have to say, I mean, I'm looking out this window. It's not, is that red? It's like fire truck red. There's a bench. And I mean, that thing looks like it was painted last week.
It was.
Place, the upkeep, was it?
Oh, yeah. We have 6 in maintenance. We have
okay.
5 in grounds
yeah.
And horticulture. We have 3 in farming.
Yeah.
We have 158 staff now.
Yeah. I mean, the upkeep here
This
is a seriously well-maintained facility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But if a client, guest, potential guest, could understand that the sense of coming here is much like it may have been in the days of Vanderbilt's or where people had huge staffs,
yeah.
could maintain them, and they could entertain in a certain style that has been lost.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist pretty much at all.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's astonishing. And I haven't even eaten yet. To your point, I've only seen the room. This is based on the welcome, the room where we're sitting here. These little, these are so delicious. These, I mean, it's I'm so happy to be here. Can I ask you? I really feel like we need to stop.
I think they
need you. Okay. Are you a forgiving type? I need to tell you something. I wasn't going to say this on air.
You were going to say your negative impressions prior to coming,
no,
perhaps?
No. What negative impressions? What I just said?
No. I thought maybe you'd have...
No, I had zero. I've been wanting to get here. It's just a function of,
I'm forgiving. You found something.
No, I was going to tell you something. I wrote this book called Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll.
Right.
You and I, there was a thunderstorm here. I don't know if you remember.
We
one of the few people interviewed by phone.
Right.
I rarely do that.
Right.
The phone lines were crackling. I was recording it. Now, ultimately, the book I wrote, I felt like I didn't want to write a survey. And I felt like I ended up focusing on New York,
sure,
San Francisco, and L.A.
Right.
I wanted it to be a narrative. I wanted characters who came and went in those three. And that's a defensible, I think, thing as a writer. And I think it was the best thing for the book.
Right.
The one interview, and there's a lot of people I didn't give much airtime to, if any. The one interview that haunts me is my interview with you. That's the one that I'm like, God, how could I not find a way to get more Patrick O'Connell in that book? I regret it to this day, and I've started a letter to you that I don't know how to write. I would never usually say this at the end of your interview, but we were talking earlier about reading the table and whatnot.
Right.
It just seemed like the right moment, so I'm happy for the listeners to hear that. But I wish I could have done you better in that book.
Well, we're right here now doing us justice.
Okay, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I'm so happy you're here at long last.
At long last.
Yes.
It's like I said, I can't wait for the tour. I can't wait for the dinner.
Absolutely.
I can't wait to eat the rest of these little snacks we have here. Thank you for making time for me. I know there's 15, 16, of my colleagues descending on, they're starting to arrive. I see one, thank you for the time during this busy day.
Thank you. This was great. Thank you. And I hope you'll find a moment to wander off by yourself and just be alone with the area.
Thank you. I actually brought my running
kit
and running shoes for tomorrow morning. That's how my day is going
to
start, unless it's
pouring.
Because
it is one of the last unspoiled little villages where not much has changed since the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And you get a real perspective on that. I always say a film could be shot here. And it could be 1920, 1940, 1950. 100%. Just change a few of the cars.
The cars, right?
And the accents are...
Yeah. And put antennas on the roofs. All right, Chef.
Okay.
This was awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn, that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with two microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
Hey, are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week, I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to turn you over now to my interview with Lincoln Carson. Okay, so Lincoln Carson just opened this restaurant, Bon Temps.
Yep.
Bon Temps. Means good times. It's a Louisiana term. People have heard the term "let the good times roll." He is mainly known for decades as a pastry chef. You are a pastry chef. What is your? You guys are both in L.A.
Yeah.
How do you guys know each other?
Of course.
And?
I know Lincoln from back in before Michael Mina, before the Mina days.
Yes.
Yeah. He's so intense. He loves perfection.
Yeah.
He's fun too. He's a fun guy. I like his croissant that's filled with the everything.
I haven't had that.
The cream cheese.
Yeah.
Oh, I can taste it right now. You know when you taste food
yes.
and you still taste
and
it?
And it's just there. It's
still
right there.
I can
yeah.
still taste
well,
it.
Well, to your point, I knew him, and I hadn't seen him in the 25 years since. He was the pastry chef at a place called Cascabel Restaurant in New York City. Tom Valenti was the chef. And Lincoln was the pastry chef. I was their PR guy back in the day for that restaurant. And he did a peppermint... I think he called it a peppermint bomb, but it was sort of cylindrical and it had these like chocolate, I don't know what you call them, bits on top hanging out, like these little broken up pieces of sheeted out chocolate. And I still remember that dish to this day.
Yeah.
I know what you mean about intense. He's into motorcycles. I always remembered him wearing a motorcycle jacket.
Yes.
And he still looks, he looks a little older, but not old. And he is that guy.
First time I met him was he was at Danielle in Vegas.
Okay.
And I walked in to go visit Danielle. And as I walked in, I saw family meal on the table. And I thought nothing of grabbing a plate and just sitting down. And I looked over and I didn't know who he was in the pastry station. I started eating my food and interviewing him, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
And he didn't know who I was and where I came from. I was very intent on getting to know him. And he was very intent on focusing on his work. Always.
Yeah, I can see that. He looks like a photographer. You know, he's very lean. He wears the motorcycle jacket, t-shirt, jeans. He's very fit. There's not a lot of excess to him in any way.
At all.
Do you know what I mean?
Indeed,
he could be a war photographer. He could be a retired athlete. He's got that vibe.
Make him sound like G.I. Joe.
I don't think so. Well, I mean, not so militant, I don't think.
Right.
More disciplined, but
disciplined,
not militant. Yeah. But anyway, I think that you're going to enjoy this interview. It's a very different interview from the Patrick one because we knew each other when we were kids, Lincoln and I, and then hadn't seen each other since. So we do trade notes on some important New York chefs and restaurants, and then we kind of follow his career as it made its way west when I was not in touch with him. And he's teased up this new restaurant that just opened, I think, in the last couple of days. Yeah, but it is open. It's in the Arts District of Los Angeles, which is hopping right now. There's all kinds of places there. And I hope you'll go check it out if you're in the area. I tried to say hi to him when I was there. I couldn't connect. I was able to look from a nearby hotel through the window into his space. But there was one cook there doing some kind of, I don't know, maybe testing or something. It was late at night. I was having a drink there with a friend of mine, but I couldn't connect with Lincoln. But I will next time I get to L.A.
I'm headed to L.A. after this.
So you're going to go.
That's first up.
Okay. So with all this, I'm going to now send it over to my interview with Lincoln Carson, recorded a couple of weeks ago in New York City, but which I sat on until the restaurant was open. Bon Tom in Los Angeles. Here you go. I was coming over here today, and I did. Have you done the math on how long it's been since we've seen each other?
No, because that would waken me up to exactly how long it has
It has
been
a quarter century.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. We met in 93.
Wow.
When you were at Cascabel Restaurant.
I was so young. I had more hair.
I remember you with like a biker jacket or a leather jacket. Am I
correct?
Yeah,
I've always... motorcycles are... I come with bikes, so yeah.
Okay.
I've had more bikes and more jackets.
That was
jackets.
Part of the kit?
Yeah.
Okay. But we haven't been in, I don't think we've been maybe a comment here or there on social media, but zero contact, haven't seen each other in that entire time, which is crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So as we do here, I want to get your whole story. And this is one of these times where you're somebody I knew, somebody I remember very fondly, but there's all this stuff I didn't know about you. First of all, is this accurate? You were born in Beirut?
Yeah, I was born in 1969.
Uh-huh.
My dad was State Department when he met my mom.
I was wondering if you were like an Army brat or something along those lines.
Yeah, it was actually in Karachi. So my mom was working in the U.S. Embassy in the Foreign Service in the early 60s. My dad was State and had been for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And they met and were married in Karachi. I've got all these amazing pictures of them in this traditional Pakistani wedding.
Okay.
But then they moved to Beirut eventually some years later. I was born there, and then he left State. And I think he joined Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company.
Okay.
So we went to Jeddah and Dhahran.
Okay.
Back to the U.S. when I was about five.
So you were a U.S. citizen?
Yes.
Because of?
Because my parents were Americans.
Right, and he was with the State Department and all that. What was it like growing up overseas up to the point that you did?
I mean, truthfully, I don't remember a whole lot from when I was very young. We did go back when I was a teenager. But I think it speaks to the way in which I was brought up and the view my parents had of the world, which was truly a world view and not falling into a very kind of singular local view.
Mm-hmm. So that's always been a part of your outlook.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you, so when you come to the States, you were junior high, high school, you were where?
Well, when I first came back to the States, I was six.
Uh-huh. Welcome back to New York.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's funny, Jen, I told you before we started, Genevieve Gerges and I interviewed in Philly. She's from L.A., mm-hmm. and the same thing happened. It's the East Coast welcome for Los Angelinos.
Well, I don't know if I can sleep here anymore. I remember, I had a little apartment on 6th and Van Damme, and I mean, it was right next to the train, and you'd feel the rumble all the time.
Oh, sure.
And like, you could sleep through anything.
Oh, yeah.
Now I'm used to quiet.
Yeah.
But anyway, so back to where I came from. So we came back to the U.S. My dad took a job in New York with the U.N. for a couple of years. And we went up to Boston after that. And I was just outside of Boston in a town called Belmont for a number of years. And then ninth grade, I think both, a little bit of both. We wound up moving back to Saudi, took another job. So we were in Riyadh and then left sophomore year in high school, came back to Belmont, and I finished high school.
Mm-hmm. So, spoiler alert, you've moved around a lot as a pastry chef.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you were conditioned for that the way you grew up? It seems like you must have grown up, at least whether or not you liked the idea of moving frequently, at least conditioned to being able to do it, to being able to kind of acclimate to a new surrounding, a new place, a new group of people.
Yeah, I think so. I think, I don't know if I was always looking for the next thing or looking for something new, but I've certainly enjoyed seeing a lot of the world, and I'm open to new opportunities and new possibilities, probably more so than some other folks that are friends of mine.
Yeah. So what was your first sort of pull toward the professional kitchen? You is this right? You thought about maybe going into the military at one point?
Yeah, I had I was really into planes at that point, and maybe that's where the motorcycle racing comes from, right? But, and my dad's family had all been in the military, and I was thinking, that might be a direction to go and learn.
You wanted to fly. You wanted to fly jets.
Yeah, or something. You know, I think jets would be the pinnacle.
Uh-huh. Did you have a vision for it?
I did. I actually still have, up until this year, I've noticed my close reading vision is suffering a little bit, but I've still got better than 20/20.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So you could have probably done it if you wanted.
I think I might be a little too tall for some of those. I've got a good...
Is something I forgot until I walked in and met you this morning, is I forgot how tall you were.
Well, one of my dear friends in L.A. is he's an ex-combat pilot. He flew an F-16 for years, and he's maybe 5'7".
Okay.
5'8".
Yeah. And you're what? You must be like
6'4".
Yeah. Okay. So what was your first sort of pull toward the kitchen?
I think, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, to be honest with you. I mean, I had accepted or deferred admission to a couple of colleges. It was right after high school, obviously. It was at that point my parents had split, and I was going to be picking up a good portion of the bill of going to school, and all my friends were going to college, and it was just the thing that... That's what you did, right? You go to school.
Yeah, it was sort of an unexamined decision for a lot of people.
So then the question begs the next question, well, what are you going to school for? And I could never answer that. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I took a year off, which I think was one of the better decisions I've made.
After high school.
I've always had a job. My first job was a paper route, probably when I was like 12, you know, delivering the Boston Globe in the snow. not so smart.
Right.
But I took a couple of odd jobs. I mean, I worked in the mailroom at Fidelity Investments for a little while. I was a chimney sweep.
Wow.
My dad had moved to Turkey. I went to Ankara and visited him for a couple of months. And I just started realizing how much I enjoyed food and how much and you know what did it? There was a catalyst, like there was this aha moment of making just a really good cup of coffee and realizing like the minutiae of that process.
Really? Was this overseas?
No, this was in Boston.
What technique? Because you and I, we're dating ourselves. Because now everybody knows what a plunger pot is, but when you and I were growing up, that was not assumed
it was like
knowledge.
Molina or
that
something.
Like there was the drip thing with the cone and the. Right?
I think it was just getting the right ratio and realizing like, wow, there's actually something that you can do something that matters to make this right.
Yeah.
And then I also had the good fortune of having one of my best friends from high school. Had accepted to go to culinary school, took a year off as well so he could save up some money, was working as a line cook, and he kind of introduced me to the idea, and I put two and two together, and I thought, well, I've always been kind of artistic. Maybe I should go check it out.
Now, I need to ask, because this is something else I did not know. Is this Mark?
It is.
Okay, so you were buddies with Mark Ladner.
Yeah, we were since sophomore year in high school.
Yeah, for people who don't know that name, I haven't had him on this show yet. I had him on the Front Burner, which I used to do with Jimmy Bradley when he was getting ready to launch Pasta Flyer, his quick cook pasta concept. But Mark was someone who basically is an incredibly nimble. I could see why you guys get along because he kind of worked all these different jobs within the Batali Bastianich group. He was the chef at Lupa, which is the casual.
Yeah.
Place. He was the opening chef at Del Posto, which was a 4-star Italian restaurant.
Yeah, he was there for 8 years.
Yeah, I mean,
you
could just kind of point him and shoot, and he could do anything, basically. It seemed like from afar, anyway.
Yeah, he's very, he's got great vision. He's obviously very talented.
Yeah.
And very, very, I think he's a very thoughtful chef. Yeah.
So you just mentioned, it's interesting because it kind of went right by me, but you just said you'd always been sort of artistic, right? So you know, everything up to now you've described, you know, thought about maybe going into the military, you know, always had a job. You know, these are very sort of, that people usually match with, and I'm artistic. You know, it's interesting, but what how did that express itself when you were a kid?
I've been good with my hands throughout my life. I took classical bass throughout school. I always did fairly well in art class and sought out like additional mediums. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would never say I was an artist, but you know, I can probably put together a nice line drawing here and there if you force me to.
You had a visual sensibility.
Yeah,
You feel like you had good taste.
that may be debatable. But
oh, really?
Yes.
No, but I mean, buildings or in.
Yeah, and I mean, in later years, I thought, wow, architecture could have been something, but who knows? I think I found the right thing, or it found me.
Yeah. So you end up going to Johnson & Wales, and what was that experience like?
So I went to Johnson & Wales to take a look at the classes and see what the curriculums looked like, and at the time, I gravitated towards pastry. They had two separate tracks. It was a two-year pastry program, thinking... Now I realize, wrongfully so, but thinking that was a better artistic outlet or medium, only because it seemed outwardly more literally artistic. I mean, making showpieces, working with chocolate, working with sugar, which are things that I don't really do very much anymore. And I realized how artistic you can be with any part of, you know, cooking or restaurant. And I did really well at school as far as the practical. I didn't do any of the homework. Honestly, I thought it was pointless. The whole idea of coming to this, you know, technically based school is to learn with your hands and be part of it. And there were some very talented pastry chefs there at the time. I'm sure there still are. So I remember one Swiss pastry chef who taught me chocolate in a bout of frustration gave me a B for the class because I was probably doing the best work in the class, but I didn't turn in any of the homework that was required to get to that point. But my feeling was, well, it's in the technique and the finished product. Why should I do the homework?
Right.
So I kind of shot myself in the foot there, but nobody cares, right?
Well, I mean, think anyone was looking at your whether you had an A or a B when you started going around looking for a job.
So it was a good experience. You know, it really...
What, was it a two-year program?
It was a two-year program, so it grounded me in the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a foot in the door, you know, got me, at least I could get in to a job and then see how it went.
What about, was it a tough call settling on pastry? And I just feel the whole idea of pastry chefs to me, it's so interesting, right? Because I think for the most part, at least in the classic way we think about it, you know, most restaurants are known for the chef who's doing the savory side of the menu, right? And then I think a lot of times the job as a pastry chef is to fit that, you know, or to do something that would make sense after two or three courses of that other guy's stuff.
It's true. I mean, it should.
Did you feel that going into it? And was that something that you liked? Was that a challenge?
I don't think I was that aware right away. I mean, I was just, you know, I was young cook trying to learn my craft more than anything else. But I think you are absolutely right. I think, I mean, the best experiences and the best restaurant experiences are seamless, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't feel that there's kind of a dichotomy in style or that there's any shift from one point to the other. Maybe a progression, but...
Right. It seems of a piece.
Of course.
It all seems to hang together.
You know, you don't go to a... Well... I mean, now you can find anything anywhere, but, you know, the idea of having, you know, really classic French desserts at the end of, let's say, a very American meal, maybe Gotham Bar and Grill, for example, mm-hmm. like, wouldn't have made a lot of sense.
Right.
So,
right.
To your point.
Yeah. Or it's funny, Alex Stupak here now has the Midtown Empeyon.
Right.
The only place where he kind of lets his modernist history show is in the desserts. The desserts are very much in the style that he was known for at Alinea and WD-50. But the rest of the menu is not, right?
But if anywhere, and that's kind of the caveat to this, right? If there's anywhere that you're going to go a little more flourish, a little bit more esoteric, like generally a dessert seems to be accepted as being that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So when you start coming up, who are some of the first people you worked for?
So when I first moved to New York, I worked at a restaurant, and it was in the then World Financial Center, Le Pactole. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Willie Cross was the chef. He was Alsatian.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for maybe just under a year, and the restaurant wasn't doing that well. It was bouts of really busy, but mostly slow. So it wasn't really challenging me, mm-hmm. and I was looking for something. And I answered a blind ad in the New York Times. Because back then, I mean, there was no Craigslist. It was the New York Times or the Village Voice.
That's how you got
jobs,
and that's how you got apartments.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you got the...
That was the local paper,
you picked it up early in the morning, broke out a pen, and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be LeBron Dunn, and they were looking for a pastry cook. And I went in, I remember I wore a suit, and went in and interviewed with the GM. And the pastry chef had just started recently. It was Francois Payard.
Legend.
Eric Repair had been there for maybe 3 months at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a very transitional moment to get that job. And mm-hmm. I was so fortunate to get the job. And back then, I think those jobs were hard to find. There weren't that many places where you were going to get that level of training.
It was kind of the inverse of what it is right now, right? It was very much a chef/restaurateur market. Whereas 100%. Now it's very much a cook's market.
Agreed.
Now there's a shortage of cooks. It used to be there was a shortage of landmark restaurants where somebody with your ambitions would have wanted to be, right?
Oh, 100%. I knew there were 10 people lined up out the door who wanted my job.
Yeah.
So.
What was it like competing for a job at that time? Could you feel the competition in the air?
I think it fostered a somewhat healthy sense of ego. I mean, just not allowing yourself to fail, really. I mean, I had to be better than everyone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a requirement. It's like, if you're not better than the next guy, you're going to be looking for something else, or you're just going to get an average job.
Right. So you were there for what, about how long?
Just under 2 years.
Okay. Pretty long time.
Yeah, it was great. It was a really tight program. We mm-hmm. had a small crew. I think there was four or five pastry cooks under Francois. We all worked 6 days, so we got to know each other very well. Some really talented people came out of that kitchen.
Yeah.
Lisa Hershey, who we had just been mentioning, who went on to be the pastry chef at Chanterelle.
Yes.
David Carmichael was there.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, we all worked the line together.
That's crazy.
Who else was there? God. There were a few, no doubt.
But that was also back then, as it is now, that was one of a handful of four-star New York Times restaurants. I mean, it was kind of one of the pinnacle places.
It was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you eventually, you and I first met, you were at a restaurant called Cascabel.
Right.
Which probably, unless people were eating in New York at the time, most people probably don't even know what that restaurant is. But Tom Valenti, who had gotten famous at Allison on Dominic, it was his first stop after that. It was in the space that is now Michael White's restaurant, Osteria Morini, on Lafayette Street.
Okay.
And you were the pastry chef there.
Yeah, I opened it.
How did you find your way to that job?
We had a mutual friend, Mark Spangenthal.
Okay.
So I had been the pastry chef at a short-lived restaurant, Lux, Rick Lockwood.
Right around the corner from where we are.
Yeah.
In the 20s.
I think 23rd.
Right off Broadway.
22nd.
Yeah.
Rick Lockwood was the chef. I took the job very excited because they had gotten a 3-star New York Times review. Uh-huh. I was the pastry chef. Yep. But unbeknownst to me, things were going a little bit south financially for the restaurant. Mm. So it didn't last very long. But Mark Spangenthal was the CDC.
Okay.
And he later introduced me to Tom, as he had...
They had been at the Gotham together.
He had been at the Gotham with Tom, and I think he had been at Allison with Tom early on.
Okay. So that was... So Tom's food, this is... I don't know if they told you, but when your PR firm got in touch to book this, I said, tell him I remember the peppermint bomb.
No, they didn't.
From Cascabel Restaurant. I can still see it.
Oh, that's funny.
If I'm remembering right, I think it had a chocolate base...
It was,
and it was a peppermint, like a half sphere.
Oh, it was cylindrical, but it was peppermint ice cream.
Okay,
and it had the fashion in the day had about 6 inches of height to it with chocolate decor.
Yeah,
kind of very whimsically.
Yeah,
placed on the top.
But that was very. We were talking about how what the pastry chef does has to kind of mesh with what. Tom's food was very... He was famous for a braised lamb shank.
Mm-hmm.
He was famous for very... People would use words like lusty and soulful. And
he
did very unabashedly flavorful food, right? He seasoned things to the brink, right? Your desserts very much fit that. I mean, going for a meal at that restaurant, your taste buds got a ride. Did it feel like that was what you guys were doing back there?
No, I think... I wish I could say I was that thoughtful back then.
Really? You were just doing your thing?
I was exploring. Like, that was the restaurant where I really started to discover who I was as a chef.
Uh-huh.
And you're right. I mean, Tom's food just kicked you in the head. It was all delicious. And it was craveable. And you had it once and you wanted it again.
Yeah.
Right? And I think he really helped me just kind of let loose a little bit.
Interesting.
You know?
Well, that would also make sense because he was kind of atypical in that he never went to cooking school.
Yeah.
Right. So he was.
But he worked for Guy Savoy in Paris. And,
yeah, and Alfred Portale here.
Yeah.
But I think he always had sort of a, you know, a streak of sort of go your own way. You know, wasn't bound by doctrine, I think. Anyway.
No, I agree. I mean, convention be damned, right?
Yeah. But when you think back to when you say you started figuring out who you were, what were some desserts where you feel like some tumblers were sort of falling into place for you?
I think that one was pretty pivotal because I had always had this love affair with mint chocolate chip ice cream.
Okay.
And that's kind of where that came from. I didn't get a lot of sweets as a kid, but every now and then we'd get Breyers mint chocolate chip.
Okay.
And like that was the thing.
So you found a way to kind of match that with your training and
exactly,
New York
and
City restaurant setting.
Take it to a different place.
And,
and the other thing I don't think you know about that dessert is I was having a really hard time finding black peppermint or like a really strong pungent flavor of peppermint that would give it that like punch of flavor. So we started growing it on the roof of the restaurant.
No, I had no
so
idea
I had,
about
I
this.
Had a little farm up on peppermint
oh
farm
God.
Up on the roof.
How advanced. Look at you.
I know. Crazy, right?
Yeah.
Farm to table back before.
Yeah, well... before it had a name.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was a good excuse to get up on the roof and that's what you did, right?
Right.
But there were a few. I mean, I do remember, you know, the thing about that restaurant and that job and also maybe being that young and impetuous is taking chances mm-hmm. and putting stuff on the menu that maybe wasn't ready
mm-hmm.
and evolving it while it was still going on the plate. And, mm-hmm. you know, now I probably wouldn't have put all that food out there, but I would have thought about it more. I would have tweaked it more. But there's a lot to be said for just going for it.
Can you speak for just a minute? I don't want to get too hung up on, like, the good old days, right?
Right.
But that was, to me... You know, Amanda Freitag was on this show early on, and she had been a sous. A lot of people don't know this, but episode 4, for people who want to listen, she tells great stories. She had been a sous chef at Vong,
mm-hmm.
an early Jean-Georges Von Richten sort of pan-Asian joint, and she was part of the opening team at Verbena, Diane Forley's restaurant, right?
Yeah, that's why I met her.
And we were talking about the food scene in New York at that time, just how I feel like, you know, everybody's style was so distinct. I mentioned this thing, like, I mean, I lived around the corner from Cascabel. I was your guy's PR guy.
Yeah.
And I would sometimes call up and say, you know, at 9:30, hey, would you guys hate us? Are there still people coming in? Can we come, like, sit down and get a, you know, sneak in a dinner? And just sitting there, just being overwhelmed by the end of the meal with just the flavor. You know, but I feel like New York at that time, there was all these people just really taking it as far as you could. And it was before things got too sort of silly, which I think they got later in the 90s.
Yeah.
But I just feel like everyone was sort of, it's like everyone had a new toy. That's what it felt like. And they were seeing what it could do, you know, like, and it was the Food Network had just started. There was so much excitement, I feel like, in this city just for dining.
Well, I think if you look at where we were coming from in the 80s and the late 80s, which is when I started going to culinary school, and I think your new toy analogy is spot on, right? It's like suddenly we're discovering how we can take all of these classic techniques that we've learned and apply it to our own lives, our own inspirations. And,
right,
and
like the mint chocolate chip reference point.
Agreed. I think... I think we were just going for it. And, you know, some people were going really like big food was in vogue, right? And sharp, pointy things on the plate were in vogue.
Yeah.
And, you know, taking a lot of ingredients that maybe hadn't been exposed to previously. Like there was a lot of that. The farmer's market was really starting to blossom in Union Square. We were starting to see better quality produce coming. I remember the first time I got Frais de Bois come over from France. Right, I was like, "What are these?"
Right,
you know, and it just takes you in a whole bunch of different directions.
Yeah,
and we weren't so, I think, tight as maybe some of our French mentors had been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were a little bit looser, a little bit. We didn't have the rules to follow.
Yeah,
you know,
you had the respect for tradition. You had the respect for.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Technique,
absolutely. It was. I mean, and that's the thing about New York, and I think still reigns supreme is technique has to be king here because you don't have like the bounty of Southern California every day at your doorstep.
Yeah. You think that's still true? That distinction.
I think technique. Oh, I think technique's gotten a whole lot better in California. I think it's caught up, but for a long time, I think New York chefs tended to be very technique driven.
Oh yeah,
they had to be.
Oh yeah, they got off on it, right? Like it was. That's what it. I mean, they really was. It was. It was such a huge point of pride.
And back in the day, I mean, there was always this comparison between New York and California. It's like, oh, well, you could just put a peach on the menu, you know, referencing Chez Panisse.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's not the case anymore. I think now you see a whole lot of, like, very well-trained, technique-driven chefs on the West Coast who just now have better product.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think the line's blurred a little bit because we also have... There's way more stuff being grown here. You know, one of my favorite stories from the old days was we mentioned Gotham Bar and Grill. You know, Alfred Portale wanted to do a tuna tartare. And to get sushi-grade tuna, he used to have to go down to Chinatown. And he would pick up a tuna and wrap it in newspaper and come back in a taxi.
Right.
I mean, this is like you growing the mint on the roof.
Yeah.
You know, now you could just go online and get, I'm sure, mint that would have satisfied what you were looking for. You know, and have it at your door the next morning. But everybody was trying to put their hands on stuff and doing whatever they had to do to do that. So why did you finally leave New York? What made you want to split town?
So I got a call from the Highlands Inn in Carmel. They were looking for a pastry chef. And I honestly didn't know anything about the Highlands Inn at the time. I didn't know anything about their chef. And then come to find it's a gentleman named Cal Staminov. And I had met Cal, actually, it turned out I had met Cal at Le Brendan very briefly a couple of years prior. He was there, I think, trying out for an exec sous position or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the pastry chef at Le Cote Basque, and it was a huge restaurant. We were doing monster numbers. It was a gigantic opportunity for me when I got that job, especially to learn volume. But I was kind of feeling the grind of it. And, you know, I had a really long conversation on the phone with Cal. I remember, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half. And he kind of, he convinced me that maybe I should come and take a look at it and do it and try out for the job.
Mm-hmm.
And he sounded like, you know, a true believer in what he was doing there.
Yeah.
So I hopped on a plane, flew into San Fran, rental car down to Carmel. This was in the middle of the night. I remember I showed up at the hotel at like 2 or 3 in the morning.
Right.
Didn't see anything, so I didn't know what it looked like.
Right.
You know, wake up the next morning to get into the kitchen and start prepping for my tasting. And like, I step outside and everything's just all beautiful.
Paradise.
Flowers,
yeah.
Paradise.
Yeah.
Like it smelled like perfume in the air.
Yeah.
Well,
especially coming from New York, right?
Yeah,
where
exactly.
There is no middle of the night here.
So I went and I really pushed pretty hard for my tasting. I think I did one full day of prep and then one full day for the tasting. I must have done 18 or 19 different items.
Oh, my gosh. Just you?
Just me. Yeah, no help. Showed up, everything from scratch. We didn't have things in cryovac bags. I wasn't shipping anything out here.
Mm-hmm.
And I crushed it. I mean, it was really a huge challenge, but also a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just seemed like a place that was really dedicated to food and wine and really pushing the limits of their program. And as it turns out, they were the they were running an event that was the forefront to food and wine events. It was called the Masters of Food and Wine.
Okay.
So once a year for about a week and a half, they dedicated like all of their resources to having this massive food event with all of these chefs from around the world.
So you were getting to meet all these people as
they
came through.
Yeah, and they would do multiple events throughout the year that were smaller. Like David Kinch would come down and do a dinner. Thomas Keller would come down and do a dinner.
This must have been, this was Kinch when he had, what was the name of it?
Sanssouci.
Sanssouci.
It was Sanssouci, I think.
Oh, Sanssouci.
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember doing a Masters of Food and Wine where Alain Passard is cooking right next to you, right? So it was a really special moment.
How long were you there?
2 years.
And what was your, you mentioned this difference between East and West a minute ago. How did that affect you in the, you know, in the pastry arts? Like the bounty, you mentioned the Bounty of California. Was it different cooking out there?
I think it was different for a couple of reasons. One, I was coming out bringing aforementioned technique where, you know, previously desserts that had been done there were good, but like very simple,
mm-hmm.
not multidimensional, mm-hmm. really, really straight, clean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then I'm discovering the bounty out there, not only like much, like insanely great product, you know, just think like TriStar strawberries in the season here, but you could get them there like 9 months out of the year,
yeah.
You know, or similar.
I remember my second time I ever went to Napa, someone took me to the, you know, they call it the garden across the street from the French Laundry.
Yeah.
It's basically a farm. And there were Fraise du Bois. It was November.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And they were
right?
growing. Like, they were just growing there. Yeah.
And it's seasonal because it's growing.
Yeah, but I remember being shocked by that.
But I found not only was it so special to have these ingredients coming to your door, but that you were generally meeting the people who grew them.
Right.
So now you're building relationships with these farms and farmers, and you know a lot of them were just super excited to see you using the product and what was it going into.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a whole new world.
That's great. So was it from there to Vegas?
It was.
Yeah.
So we were doing a Masters of Food and Wine. I had met Julian Serrano. And
can you explain for people who may not know who's Julian Serrano?
Okay, so Julian Serrano had been the executive chef at Masa's in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bellagio was opening, they tapped Julian for their premier restaurant, in-house restaurant. And it had been Steve Wynn's, I think, vision in that hotel to bring in like the great chefs and great food and wine and hospitality.
This was a huge deal at the time.
Oh, it was crazy.
It was like everyone in the country knew about it. There were all these eyes on it. Yeah. And Vegas, again, it sounds so funny to talk about it now, but like not around this. This is when this was the Vegas transformation. Before
this, 98, 99.
Yeah, before this time, you'd go to Vegas and it was like $9.99 all you can eat buffet. There were no, it wasn't like every chef had an outpost there the way they do now.
No, I think the only one really was Jean-Louis.
Yeah,
Jean-Louis Peladon.
Was Wolfgang there? I think Wolfgang.
Wolfgang was there. Yeah. I'm not sure in the same what capacity at that point.
Right.
But yeah,
almost
it was,
nobody.
But yeah. I think single-handedly, Steve Wynn and Elizabeth Blau,
mm-hmm.
Who was really the catalyst for this,
like yeah.
forced that change quickly.
Yeah.
So long story short, the Highlands was getting bought out by Hyatt. Cal was leaving to go open Bernardus.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the executive chef for Bernardus Lodge and Winery. And I didn't really have an out. And I'm thinking, well, what's, you know, it's all this uncertainty. What's going to happen?
Right.
Damn, my chef's leaving. You know, I'm still fairly young at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And Cal gave Julian a call and said, hey, you know, you guys saw each other's work at the Masters. You should talk to him.
Yeah.
And Julian had opened with a pastry chef, but in a lot of ways, you know, Vegas isn't the healthiest place for certain personalities, and it didn't work out. So this was a couple of months into the Bellagio being open.
Another New York alum, a chef by the name of John Schenck, who I'm sure you must know.
Yeah.
But John said to me once, if you do not have an off switch, Vegas will kill you.
Yes. Yeah. there's trouble to be had around every corner.
Yes. And it's another at all hours.
Yeah. And, you know, they industry really takes care of industry there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're working the kind of hours that we work and then you get to go and play and you're being taken care of and treated like a king, like
it can get out of hand.
Yeah, it can get out of hand pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So
you go there.
So I go there. I did a tasting. I think Julian would have hired me on the spot, but his higher ups asked, rightfully so, that I do a tasting.
You mean would have hired you based on having met you at Highlands?
At the Highlands.
And seeing what you were doing
what
there?
I was doing there.
Okay.
But Julian's higher up was Gamal Aziz at the time, who was mm-hmm. the VP of Food and Beverage at Bellagio. And I still remember that interview with him. I mean, man, what a personality. Like
how
this guy, larger than life.
Yeah.
Just really so self-confident, so 100%. Like focused
mm-hmm.
and present,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, that was a wonderful experience. I'm glad I had the opportunity to do that tasting, to have those conversations, to be.
Now, again, how does someone, you know, you'd been in New York at Cascabel, then you'd been at Highlands. Now here you're going to go to, a totally different setting, a new chef, someone very well defined, right? What was your tasting like there? Like, what was the mindset going into an audition for a job like that?
Well, it kind of falls back to what I was saying before about being in New York and being a young cook with a bunch of people lined up behind you. Like, you truly had to believe in yourself and believe, like, I am so much better than everybody else going mm-hmm. into this. And, you know, to really channel that ego about what you do and step into this role and say, I'm just going to crush it. And it really became a point of pride.
Yeah.
So going into Bellagio, and look, I remember hearing the stories about how much money they spent on Bellagio.
Mm.
And I show up there ready to, you know, they put me up, give me full comp for everything, right?
Right, sure.
Eat anywhere, drink anywhere, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And I show up and like I look at this place and it looked like somebody had spent billions of dollars on it. And they did.
Right.
It was insane.
Yeah.
Right. I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah. Was that intimidating? Exciting?
No. It was amazing.
It was.
I was just like,
put me in, coach.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I went in there. I'm like, I'm going to crush this tasting. I'm going to give them stuff they've never even seen before. Like they think they know what dessert is. Like,
this do you remember anything you put out at that tasting, or is that faded?
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably did a few things that have morphed into some of the greatest hits these days. I probably did some version of the Peppermint Bomb,
mm-hmm.
Which had gotten a magazine cover when I was doing it in the Highlands
mm-hmm.
in Carmel.
Mm-hmm.
I did a chocolate dessert that I think was featured in Food Arts at one point. That was the thing about the Highlands and doing the Masters of Food and Wine event. It really pushed you to invent things that were just at the top of your game because you were on this world stage with all these other incredible chefs, and you're doing all these courses paired with winemakers.
And also diners who had seen it all, right?
Right. I mean, yeah. I did a dessert course once paired up against a 1959 Chateau Yquem. I mean, like, that, if that's not intimidating, like, please don't fuck up this wine. Please don't screw it up.
Yeah, right. It's crazy. I have to tell you, earlier this year, I mentioned this to you before we started recording, I went down to Eric Repair's Came and Cookout event, right? And I'd never been to an event like that, really. Nothing like that. And it's on Grand Cayman. It's a very expensive ticket. There are people who go to that event every year. And I just was unaware. I mean, I'm sure I've been at events with these people, but one of them and I were very friendly. We actually, we were in the Petanque tournament together.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But this guy, we're following each other on Instagram, and he is, every time I see his Instagram feed, he's like at some dinner in a different city or some event in a different, this is his life, but there's a whole crowd like this out there. And these are the people who come to an event like that.
And those are the people that come.
And they've eaten everywhere. They've seen everything. They've tasted everything. They're used to eating, the level of meals that for most people are like a once or, something you do on your anniversary, maybe.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
And they travel to Carmel for this, massive food and wine experience. Yeah. So I think that really...
Keeps you on your toes.
It kept me sharp, and it really set me up for going and doing this tasting at the Bellagio and ultimately getting the job for the money I asked for.
Mm-hmm.
Which at that point, the other part of it, I think, was really understanding your self-worth. And I think that's something maybe a lot of pastry chefs still struggle with.
Mm. Can you speak about that? That's never come up before.
Yeah, because you're always, even the great pastry chefs, like, unless they're going off and creating their own name. I mean, I know so many truly talented people who are playing, I don't want to say second fiddle, but it's not their restaurant, it's not their name on the door, and maybe there's like an undervaluement to their job, and some of it's self-imposed. I think I've had this conversation with a lot of professionals about, well, what do I charge, what do I ask for, even when I was doing consulting, I mean, what do I charge for consulting? How do I attach a value to what I do?
Mm-hmm.
And I think early on, one of the things that I learned is, like, you're not going to get it if you don't ask for it.
Yeah.
And you have to have and it should be realistic. I mean, you should know what your value is on the market.
You don't want to seem crazy.
But at the same time, if you really are at the top of your game, then someone's going to pay for that.
So how did you figure that out? Like, let's say there's a young pastry chef out there, a young student listening to this. Is that something that you, through trial and error, figured out for yourself? Is it something that you spoke to more senior people about? Like, how did you solve that riddle?
I think the realization came about when people started asking you to come and work for them, right? When you're being actively recruited, when the last job that I had to go out and find was the ad in the New York Times, right? To Laverne and Dunn, and everything after that has always been someone approaching me. So It's do you really want that job? Do you feel that you can be successful in that partnership, in that restaurant with that chef, in that hotel?
Right.
Are they going to give you tools you need to be successful?
Yeah.
And be, what's it worth? And not to be trite about it. I mean, I don't do this for the money. I do this because I love doing it.
Right.
But you got to pay
family,
bills.
You got to pay bills. You're not living in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. So what was it like being in Vegas during this whole, I feel like there's a round two happening right now. I was just there a couple in the fall, and the amount of development in that city right now is insane. But I feel like the round one was when you were there. Like, it just all, at least on the restaurant front, all of a sudden, all these huge chefs were doing outposts there. People were, vanishing for 3 days to go there, and you knew they were there to take a meeting about opening a place or, taking over a space in a hotel. Like, everybody was flocking there. What was it like to be there and kind of see all that going on?
Well, I think we were definitely at the top of the heap at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a lot to be said for being in that rarefied air, right?
Sure.
We had all the resources. I was flying in produce from San Francisco twice a week. I mean, I don't even know what that cost. I didn't have to. It didn't matter. No one cared.
You never got questioned on it.
No, it was all about ultimate quality. Mm-hmm. I think some of that has shifted a little bit. I mean, clearly, you know, the corporate entities that own these casinos want to see a return on their investment. The shareholders need to make money.
Sure.
So they probably tightened down on some of that, but it was pretty special. I mean, whatever we needed, literally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had them redesign the pastry kitchen in Picasso because it wasn't designed very well, and they probably dumped $200,000 into that rebuild.
You just one day decided to bring it
up. Well, it was something I've been talking about with Lynn, and he said, well, how would you do it? And here's how I would do it. And guess what? They did it.
Wow. What'd you do? Like a sketch or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That was kind of the design side of my head.
Yeah. Okay. And they went ahead and did it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's not the norm.
No. No, not at all. Usually, especially coming from New York, where it's like, here's your table in the corner, make do, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've got a mixer, but you've got, you know, the mixing table also doubles as the pasta table.
Well, New York kitchen, I say they're like, it's like this, it's like studio apartments. You know, people figure out what to do with every square inch of space.
Oh, you get creative.
And a lot, yeah, a lot of, especially if the place wasn't a restaurant before.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's crazy. Or if it was a so-so restaurant taken over by a more ambitious chef. I mean, the amount of things people cram into spaces that were not meant for that, it's kind of impressive.
It is. I mean, I remember Le Cote Basque. I had a whole storage area underneath the stairs that were sort of on the backside of my pastry kitchen.
Yeah. Were you there, by the way, in the final days of that restaurant?
No, so I was there. I mean, it must have been like 95, 96. Okay. It was after Cascabel.
Okay. And had it moved?
Yes.
It was in the second place.
I came in after Richard Leach left.
Okay. Got it. All right. So tell me, let's talk about where you are now. You're in Los Angeles. You've got this huge, it's been described as a huge project.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how that happened, but
so yeah, it's called is it Bon Temp?
Bon Temp.
Bon Temp, excuse my pronunciation.
Good times.
Okay, your wife, I didn't know why you would pick that name, but you mentioned to me earlier today, your wife is from?
She's from New Orleans.
New Orleans, that's obviously a phrase associated with the culture of New Orleans, right?
Yep.
But tell us about the project.
So I kind of feel like I'm the accidental restaurateur. So my partner in the project is Sprout. So Michael Glick has been the investor in several very successful restaurants, and he's more instigator than investor, right?
That's an interesting word.
I mean, he gets in partnership with chefs he believes in, chefs he's got relationships with, and he really just gives you the resources to do the thing that you want to do. So from that point of view, it was kind of a perfect marriage.
Sort of like a patron of the arts
exactly.
type thing?
Very much so.
Am I accurate in comparing what you just said? I don't know him personally. This is my impression, and maybe you don't know enough about him, but you know, this is sort of my impression from afar of Stephen Starr on the East Coast.
I think maybe not so much because Michael doesn't really want to be an operator.
Okay.
He wants to empower me to be an operator.
Got it. Okay.
And which is what he's done.
Okay.
So we've got this space. It's in the old Heinz 57 kitchen,
mm-hmm.
Test Kitchens. It's in the Arts District. It's on Santa Fe. And I had just been in France maybe 2 or 3 months prior when I saw the space. I'm walking down. There's an outdoor alley that was gated off. Walking through that and thinking, in Europe, like, name the city or village, there'd be 5 cafes in the space, and there's nothing here right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it really spoke to me from that regard, from that sort of European mentality and restaurant aesthetic. I really felt like this was this beautiful brick-lined alley with 2 very beautiful old industrial buildings on either side. It's bordered by my building and then an old firehouse, a historic landmark firehouse next to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't get my head around why there wasn't something in that alley. And it had been a restaurant previously, but it had been shut down for a couple of years.
Okay.
So that really spoke to the concept for me. And, you know, I had been consulting with a couple of other projects that were open all day. I had come down to L.A. originally to open up Superba Food and Bread, mm-hmm. which was an all-day concept.
Yep.
And you know, I really had a vision for how I would do it were it mine, and that's what I based the concept on.
Mm-hmm. And the How much can you? I mean, you're not open. You're going to be open. You're thinking late spring, we'll call it.
Yeah, late spring. I would say June will be open.
Okay.
So
how much can you tell us about like the menu and?
Quite a lot. I mean, we've spent a lot of time in a test kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
The overall concept I'd describe as modern California brasserie, and you know that kind of covers a lot of ground, but it. Much in the same way that I was trained in classical French technique, and particularly with pastry, but I'm by no means a French chef or a French pastry chef, I look at this restaurant. And the idea being that we're really taking inspiration from the Grand Brasserie tradition and then bring it, you know, to this point of modernity. Is that a word?
Modernity? Sure.
You know, in the Arts District in L.A., and we're not trying to be a French restaurant in the Arts District. We're trying to be an Arts District restaurant that's, you know, speaking to where we've come from in our traditions and in our training.
Yeah. What is it? That neighborhood is such a, it's taken off.
It's crazy. I also live literally next door to the restaurant.
Okay. Literally next door.
So as this... he cringes.
Well, that's good and bad, right?
Yeah, it's good and bad. I think right now it's very good. You know, it'll get to a point where I'm outgrowing the space with my family and we need to find something bigger.
Right.
But right now it allows me to be there when I need to be there and
without
have
the variable...
Without
the variable traffic.
Exactly. And I also thought it was important to be part of the community that you're opening a business in. I didn't think it was responsible. You know, I'd been living in Santa Monica and opening a business in the Arts District, which I really didn't know that much about.
Right.
You know, that doesn't make sense to me.
So you referred to yourself as an accidental restaurateur. But I don't know. It feels like from everything else you've said about your background, your sort of proclivities as a kid, you know, this tendency toward design, you know, always having a job. It seems to me like you're probably constitutionally pretty well suited to this. Do you feel like you've also been around the business long enough to probably model what you're doing from that side, you know, modeling yourself after operators you've respected and not imitating management style that you didn't respect, right? You've had a lot of people that you can sort of look at the good and bad of.
Well, that's, I mean, you're hitting a lot of points. As far as the accidental side, I just say that because I wasn't looking to open a restaurant. I was actually working on like an artisanal business-to-business viennoiserie project.
Okay.
And that was a pitch I made, and it wound up kind of getting shelved to do this. And I couldn't be happier. But I had never, if you had asked me 2 years ago, do you want to open a restaurant or what is your goal? This probably wasn't it. But it's just the way everything sort of fell into place.
Right. This is why you used the word instigator about Michael before.
Yeah, a little bit. But to the other aspects, I mean, you're right. I'm able, like, the most important thing about this to me is I'm able to build a culture or am trying to build a culture in a restaurant that addresses everything I believe in and rails against everything that I don't believe in.
Like what, for example? Like what's important to you?
I mean, from the very beginning, collaboration, I think, is one of the first words I use when I talk about this.
Yep.
It is a collaborative effort. It has so many hands and so many fingers in this recipe right now to build this. And I think, you know, I've helped bring some of the right people and given them the direction, but also known when to take a step back and let them do what they do and be really good at it. I mean, I've had a very direct hand in the design process, but I've got an incredible team of designers, the husband and wife, also live in the Arts District, who just have done such beautiful work. But they've listened to what the needs are. They've listened to what I'm trying to achieve with the restaurant. And I want to take the collaborative effort, you know, through into operations. I mean, I can't run this thing by myself. We're going to be open all day, 7 days a week eventually. It's 7,000 plus square feet. It's a big thing. So to have people who are professionals who I think get it, who are part of the team, and everybody's voice matters. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately, I'm going to make the call, but
yeah.
You know, I want that collaborative effort in this room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to approach it from a whole house ideal, and I know people talk about that, but you know, this is the place where I don't want to see the saran wrap marked pastry only on it, like stuck in the corner. And it's like, oh, don't touch that. Pastry chef will get pissed. You know, and people who work in kitchens immediately get what I'm saying.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But also to the point where, you know, I'd like to find ways for the back of the house to maybe take some front of the house roles, deliver some of the food. I mean, who better than the cook who mm-hmm. cooked that particular course or dish to drop it at your table and tell you about it?
Yeah. I love it when that happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's important that everyone feels like they've got each other's backs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that just because you were trained in a specific role and your responsibilities are about specific duties.
Sure.
Doesn't lessen your awareness of what's going on around you, and hopefully I've empowered people to be able to feel comfortable enough to jump in and help out where they need to
mm-hmm.
or ask for it.
So you know, having been having spent time in the number of different major markets that you have, right? What's for you? What distinguishes doing business in Los Angeles or doing what you do in Los Angeles? Like, what would you say is the main point of distinction that you don't? You know, you wouldn't associate with New York, Northern California, Vegas. Like, what makes LA LA from your vantage point?
I mean, as we spoke earlier, you know, kind of offline, I'm still figuring it out. I'm amazed at how many layers there are to LA. The diversity is second to none. You know, I moved down there and not sure I was going to stay there. And the mm-hmm. longer I stay there, the more I love it.
Mm-hmm.
The more there is to discover, and yet there's all this new projects happening, new build-outs happening, new chefs moving there, new restaurants, new museums. You know, so we've got all of these things to look forward to, but I still haven't even scratched the surface on what's already been there.
Mm-hmm.
I really feel from a restaurant standpoint, it is probably the most collaborative or supportive market that I've been in.
Beyond the four walls of your own place.
Beyond the four walls of my own place. I think the community there truly is a restaurant community.
Mm-hmm.
And I've opened, as you know, I've opened a lot of restaurants in a lot of parts of the country. I worked for Michael Mina for 8 years,
mm-hmm.
Opening 28 or something. I'd lost count.
Amazing.
But
amazing how many things we talked about already. We didn't even get to,
But to that point, so I've been part of openings in a lot of different markets, and mm-hmm. some of them have been more supportive than others, and some of them were excited to see us come in, and others not so much.
Sure.
And I feel like Los Angeles, like everyone I know in the industry is amped about another restaurant opening. It's mm-hmm. not about, oh, there's more competition. It's about, I can't wait to see what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And I have gotten so much support in very real terms, both, you know, and here's a great product I've seen. Here's a purveyor you should talk to. Here's my kitchen to come and use. Here are some cooks that I think have learned everything they're going to learn from me. I want them to work for you. I mean, those are all things that happen.
That's pretty amazing.
It's great.
I also feel like, you know, it's whatever. I get very, I don't know, a little hokey talking about Los Angeles, but you know, the climate there, what you're talking about, the less stressful environment, people seem to me to stay at, you know, I had Michael McCarty on this show recently of Michael Santa Monica.
Yeah.
There's all these people who were his peers and his contemporaries. They're all still working. And a lot of them, you know, look, Nancy Silverton,
right.
You know, she's like making the scene at all these festivals. She's got these very successful restaurants. She just recently announced she's going to do two more, you know, in L.A. This is someone who was cooking back in the 70s. So I find the intergenerational aspect of L.A. to be pretty amazing, you know, to have people of that generation still vibrant, still working, and then people...
And still relevant, right?
And still relevant, and then people coming up, you know, in their late teens, early 20s, maybe working for them, you know, or as part of their group. That's not common, I don't think.
Yeah, I think
in New York, a lot of those, to be honest, a lot of those people have just been ground down.
I think you're right. I mean, I haven't thought about it in those terms before. But there are some very long careers. And, you know, I think maybe there is a little bit more of a goal of work-life balance. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm not going to say we always find it. Like, clearly, this is not the profession for that.
Yes.
But, I mean, it's a goal of mine. I would really like to see us build a restaurant that, you know, knock on wood, we're successful and matter to the restaurant community, mm-hmm. and provide great product and great service, but also, you know, everyone can work 5 days
right.
and have a life and find right. some balance in their world.
Yeah.
You know,
that's great. You seem really happy.
I am. I'm in a good spot.
Yeah. You also don't seem, I mean, usually when I see someone this close to opening, especially, you know, I was getting ready to talk to you and I was doing this, I was looking at articles from a year ago talking about, you know, this imminent opening, right? Yeah. So I'm used to, that's normal, that it takes a little bit longer. I'm used to people either seeming completely overwhelmed and stressed out or just like beyond frustrated, right? And you just seem so, I don't know, you seem very tranquil and very sort of in control of where you are right now.
I've been through all of that for sure. I mean, I've definitely had a couple of freak out moments. But then, you know, you come to terms with it, you get mm-hmm. past it, and you dig in deep, right?
Yeah.
I think the thing that I've discovered most about myself in this process is how much more capable I am at things than I thought I was. Right? So I've opened a lot of restaurants, but I've never been the decision maker for everything.
Yeah.
And it's never all been my responsibility.
Yeah.
And when I say it out loud, it freaks me out a little, but... You know what? Like, you just got to do it.
You know what's funny?
I don't have a choice.
When I was an intern, long time ago, only a few years before you and I last saw each other, though, but when I was an intern in the film business, I remember someone talking about considering their next job, right? And they'd been approached for something. And I said, well, are you qualified for that? This is someone I worked for. And they were like, no, but you're never really qualified for the next big leap, right? Like,
yeah,
you're not. Like, you're going to find out if you can do it, you know, and if you've picked up enough by osmosis and, you know, just are you innately smart enough? Are you a hard enough worker and all of that? But, like, you've never done the next job, right? Like, almost by definition.
Well, that's the thing.
And sounds like you're finding out that, like, yes, over X number of decades in this business working hard, you've absorbed a lot of sort of just institutional knowledge that you probably never had to call on, but it's there.
And you never really know what you don't know until right. you're in it, right?
Yeah.
But I think I'm fortunate for those that I've been able to work for and work with. I've got a lot of people who I shout out to and ask for opinions mm-hmm. and help. I think the overwhelming stuff sometimes are those things you just don't have control over. You know, the DWP, whether they're going to be there on time to get your electrical upgrade in, you know, the health department corrections that need to happen, even mm-hmm. though they approved the plans, they got on site and decided they didn't like the way something looks.
Right.
You know, and some of that can get a little overwhelming. And I'm not going to lie, it's a little easier being here having this conversation where I'm not being distracted by being in the space and looking at all the things that need to get done.
Yes.
So
we're 3,000 miles from your job site.
Exactly. So I have plenty of time to freak out again on Thursday.
Right. And it's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day in New York City.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm coming out. And, I mean, hopefully I'll be able to leave. If you're not open, maybe I'll come by and...
Yeah, please do. I'd love to show you.
And invite myself over for a tour.
It's... Without exaggeration, it's a really like beautiful space.
I can't wait to see it.
I think we did a pretty good job, both from an operational viewpoint and in the kitchens and mm-hmm. the equipment, to literally like picking out a car-sized block of Carrara marble that was then cut to all of the tabletops and bar tops, and getting your fingers in all of that process too.
Yeah, great. Well, I can't wait to see it. I know Los Angeles can't wait to see it. And it's funny, you know, we were talking before, I'm like 80 shows in. One of the great things has been, I've met a lot of chefs I'd never met before. I think you're easily the person I'd been out of touch with the longest, who I got to reconnect with through the show. So this is great. It's great to see you. And I'm going to see you again next month when I come out to LA.
Really look forward to it.
Okay, all the best with the project.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Sherry Yard, thank you for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
You could be my co-host.
Anytime.
Look at this.
Here
we
you.
Just
I'll
met
fly
a month
anywhere.
Ago.
I'll fly
and
all
now
over
we're
the
like,
world. We're besties.
We're besties. Thank you. I appreciate it. You helped me out today. Patrick O'Connell, I don't know what to say. I'm going to come see. I'm going to find a way to spend time with you. I want to be your buddy. Lincoln Carson, great to reconnect. Congratulations on opening the new restaurant. I want to thank Jeep Paul, our engineer, for splicing this thing together, as always. And to the team at Heritage for your support. I appreciate it. Thank you all out there for listening. If you feel like it, please drop us a rating or even better, a review at Apple's podcast store. It does help people find the show, and we really appreciate it. And that's it for this week. We will see you back here next week with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.